Good morning and welcome to the Chelan County PUD Board of Directors meeting. We are at February 20th and welcome to everyone. At the table this morning is our general manager, Steve Wright, board clerk, board attorney, and four commissioners. And Randy Smith, the fifth commissioner, is on the phone, so we have a quorum. Would appreciate it if you would, if you have a cell phone, that's kind of a ubiquitous question or statement. Since you have a cell phone, let's please have them in a silent position. And to those of you from the public who would like to address the commission, you're certainly welcome to. And come to the microphone that is at the table across from the board and utilize the microphone. Please state your name and address. And you'll have a reasonable time to be able to present your thought. Any comments or questions? Hearing none, we'll open the meeting with the Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minute by Dan Ferguson.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning. I'm Dan Ferguson. I'm a control system engineer with Chelan PUD, and I'm here to talk about situational awareness. So what is situational awareness? Situational awareness is being aware of what's happening around you in terms of where you are, where you're supposed to be, and whether anyone or anything around you is a threat to your health or safety. You should regularly ask yourself the following questions. Is there anything around you that poses a threat to your health or safety? And if so, to what extent? Is the threat big enough that you should stop working? Is there anything you can do to reduce the risk and continue working safely? You can use the SLAM technique when you start work on a new project, in a new environment, or when working with new coworkers. SLAM stands for stop, look, assess, and manage. Stop. Engage with your mind before your hands. Look. Look at your workplace and find the hazards to you and your coworkers. Assess. Ask yourself, do I have the knowledge, training, and tools to do the task safely? And finally, manage. If you feel unsafe, stop working. Tell your coworkers to stop working and report the situation to your supervisor. Remember, if you see something unsafe or spot a hazard, don't ignore it. Take the responsibility to notify your coworkers and your supervisor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Dan. Any questions, comments? Much appreciated.
Thank you very much.
Let's take a look at the agenda, please, and the approval of it. Any additions, corrections, modifications?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move resolution items 14 and 15 to consent.
Any additional comments or corrections? Hearing none, commissioners, what are your thoughts?
Good.
Okay. Any objections? Okay. We'll move resolutions 14 and 15 to the consent agenda. Mr. Wright, item number three, please.
So, we have been talking about trying to increase personal accountability at the district, and we created this cycle of personal ownership award that comes out monthly, and we have a couple of winners here today. I'd like to ask them both to come up if they could, Patty Wachtel and Jim Kill, and I don't think Gina is here today. Is that right, Jim? So maybe you could come up and both for yourself and represent her as well. Just come on up and sit at the table if you wouldn't mind for just a moment. So Patty is in our safety group, and she does just a fantastic job of keeping track of worker injury claims and helping us with trying to understand how we can get people back to work in a meaningful way. And it helps us to manage our costs as well when we get people back to work and jobs that they can perform without re-injuring themselves. Just tremendous in terms of the level of effort. You can't walk by her space without seeing her there, focused on getting her job done. And she was nominated by her peers and recognized for the tremendous work that she has done. Jim took on the governor control project down at Rock Island, and very successfully, he He challenged us, in fact, at one point, Randy Smith will remember, as to the value that our own employees can provide in terms of getting this work done, and then went out and proved it in terms of getting a project done, completed on time, on budget, and relative to using contractors, saving us about $500,000 per unit. Just a tremendous job of, again, owning the problem and going and finding solutions and making it work. So we're just super proud of both these folks and want to take a moment to have them be recognized here in front of you. Yep. And as always, we tell them that they have the opportunity, but not the requirement. If they would like to say something, we'd like to give them that chance here.
I just thank you, and I'm honored to be recognized. And as I said before, I take pride in my work and just doing my job and love working and taking care of our employees here at the district.
Congratulations, Patty.
Yeah. Patty, yep.
I'll say congratulations to Patty also. I know she does a lot of work behind the scenes that people don't see. They maybe hear about it or they get the benefit of it, but I know she does a lot of above and beyond stuff for people, so appreciate that. So, yeah, you're welcome. And as far as our group, I mean, I told the senior team that, you know, we really appreciate their trust and acknowledgement of our work, our group's work, and that we do. You know, we love doing the work we do, and that just to thank them for their support to, for us to continue doing this work, and all of our groups out there at the hydros, and, you know, the mechanics, the wiremen, the operators, the technicians. We all, you know, really have a lot of ownership in our jobs, and there's a lot of extremely talented people out there that can do amazing jobs. I've been here 30 years, and I've seen some amazing projects, and just the people, the things that people take on that you just think, and there's no way, you know, and they just jump in, and if it's something they've got to figure out and learn, then that's what we do, you know. So, and there's always people more than willing to step in and learn the new task or learn the new skill to be able to perform the work and get it done, you know, the way we would want it done. And that's where our ownership comes from, was being able to get our hands on that work and put our initials on it, you know, when we're done. I just want to also thank everybody for supporting our apprenticeship program. I've been involved with the Apprenticeship Training Committee for a number of years, and we've got like 24 apprentices right now, including the linemen, the wiremen, the mechanics, technicians. So that's really, really means a lot to us to have that program, you know, thriving. And it's amazing that our groups, we have our apprentices go from different sites to work at Rocky Reach, Rock Island. They get to spend time at Chelan and our switch charge and all that. And everywhere they go, they get reviewed monthly. And to see the reviews, there's people from all these different groups that they get to go interact with and learn from. They're so impressed and in awe of the capabilities and the just the quality of the people that we've hired into these positions. It's just, I mean, you really see that when they go out and have to work with a new group that they've never met, you know, and the people's responses from working with them is just amazing. You know, they're just like, wow, where did you find these people? It's like each one is better than the last. I mean, it's just, so it's really neat to see that, you know, that the program is working the way it should, and people are really stepping up and thriving in it. And so anyway, just, you know, want to acknowledge that and appreciate your support, and I want to keep that program going. So thank you.
Thank you.
Right. And
congrats.
Personal thanks to Patty, over the 12 years, she certainly is willing to ask commissioners appropriate questions and, you know, involve herself in an area where she would like clarification. And we've had a lot of, I think, really productive conversations over the time. So, Patty, I, you know, when you say behind the scenes, I appreciate you and your willingness to do that. So keep it up. And Jim, I can't tell you how much this means just in terms of utilization of our own staff to do the good quality work that they can, not to mention $500,000 chunks of change that make a significant difference. So thank you for the leadership in that and the quality of work and being cognizant of costs and time and those kinds of issues really do make a difference. So thanks for that leadership.
Yeah, you're welcome. Just one more point, if I can. Commissioners McKenna and Arsenal came out to our safety meeting this morning at Rock Island, And I just let you know that that really is meaningful to the group and the people that to see that you, you know, are taking ownership in our safety and coming down and spending that time. And I would just, you know, challenge everybody to take time, come out to where we work and see what we're doing and stop and meet these people, you know, that they're doing all this work and see what their day is like and what their challenges are and or successes, you know. So, I mean, if anybody, you know, in all the groups, it's just neat to see, you know, the acknowledgement that, yeah, we see what you guys are doing and how hard the work is. So, thank you.
Yeah. Commissioner Smith?
Yes. I would be remiss if I didn't point out that both of these two that are sitting before you today, you know, got a solid grounding up in Kashmir earlier. Jim and I had a little exchange earlier this morning, and I told him that what he's done goes well beyond ownership into the leadership realm. And I really appreciate the leadership that he showed a while back in stepping up and challenging the management team to say, hey, we want to do this. We know we can do this. And that leadership is a powerful asset in our organization. And I just want to say thank you to both of them. Much, much appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you
both very much.
Meeting 7.
Yeah, Jim, with the last name of Kill, you probably don't have any problems getting volunteers to work with you. just checking. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Item 4.
Next up is our Audit Committee annual report. Stacy Tegla will be here.
Hi, my name is Stacy Jagla. I'm the internal audit manager for the district, and I'm here to present the 2017 Audit Committee annual report to the board. The committee charter requires an update of the committee activities to the entire board, and we have been performing this presentation since the creation of the committee in 2004. So you're probably very familiar with how we go about this. Our board representatives for 2017 on the committee were Commissioner Smith and Commissioner Arsenault. And as you've read through the committee annual report, you'll see through the meeting summaries that the components of the committee charter that we cover at every meeting are presentations from our external auditors. The district received a clean audit from PricewaterhouseCoopers this year on our financial statement audit for 2016. The state auditor's office comes and they presented a clean audit on the district's 2016 accountability and single federal audit, which is our grant compliance. They also presented two audits for the Energy Independence Act for our 2015 renewable energy compliance and our 2014-15 energy conservation compliance. So we had clean audits there. Also through the committee, you'll see in there in the summaries the approval of internal audit work plan every year. The committee provides an independent reporting mechanism for internal audit, and we also share the results of our audits that we perform throughout the year through the audit committee. We've got updates in there from the district's enterprise risk management and our compliance functions. And lastly, you'll see information in the summary about our financial reporting updates on accounting items. It also runs through the committee as well. So, and you've probably read through that, and I don't need to go through it in its entirety, but that kind of summarizes what we do at each of our quarterly meetings. Those are kind of the standing agenda items that we cover. I know all of the commissioners have had an opportunity to serve on the committee. Commissioner McKenna had the chance to sit in at our last quarterly meeting and was exposed to it a little bit, but I'm sure he'll get his chance for the entire year. So
we're sure that he will.
Yes. So for 2018, our representatives are Commissioner Bowles and Commissioner Arsenault will be joining us again for his second year. Yeah. So thank you. Any questions specifically? the committee.
No, Stacy, just a comment. You know, I appreciate fully your integrity in the office that you have.
Thank you.
And I have no doubt about, you know, where we are and how hard you and your group work. And leadership starts at the top, and your sense of integrity helps this organization be the quality that it is, and thank you for that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Number five.
Okay, so next up, recall back in December, we made a presentation on the Chelan Rotary proposal for a planet walk in our park, and that the board gave us some direction and asked us to pursue an agreement with Chelan Rotary. So we'd like to give you an update on that. I'm going to ask our team to come on up. Y. Peterson, Ryan Baker, and I know Russ Jones is in the audience, and we'll certainly be asking him to comment as well.
Did it freeze it up already? There we go. Phew. Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Ryan Baker. I'm the Parks Manager here at the Chelan County PUD.
And Y. Tim Peterson, Parks Superintendent for the Chelan area.
So, like Mr. Wright mentioned, we're here to provide an update with regard to the Chelan Riverwalk Planet Signage Project. I really wanted to address a couple of questions that came up last time we were here in December. One of the questions had to do with ways of minimizing some of the concerns that staff had with the location and size of the signs. We did that by performing a walkthrough, and Y. Tim will provide a little bit more information on that here shortly. The other question that came up was, what do our customers think? And a big thank you to our communications department that put together a comprehensive survey. I'd like to go through some of the results of that survey if I can here. In front of you, you will notice that we had over 100 responses from the survey. 90% roughly were customers of the PUD. 72% of the folks actually indicated they would like to visit the display. And some of the comments that came out of this survey, most appealing, were educational and fun, a good reason to visit the park. Some of the comments that were maybe not most appealing were the signs may be big, distracting, maybe targets for graffiti or vandalism, junk, or maybe a waste of money. But again, to talk about some of those mitigation factors, why I can go through those at this time.
Well, thanks, Commission. So like Ryan mentioned, we did have a walkthrough on site, which really helped reduce some of the original concerns that we had when it was proposed. And so Russ, myself, Mr. Baker, and Mr. Vaughn with the real estate did a walkthrough on site. Originally, the signs were proposed to be 7 feet tall. Now we're looking at 4 feet tall just to minimize the obstruction of that. And we didn't know really the placement, where they'd be on the trail, on the riverside, on the hillside. So the walkthrough was extremely helpful, just to identify some of those concerns. So it's a one-year term, and it'll renew annually. The Rotary is going to be responsible for the install, maintenance, repairs if needed, and then removal as well if needed. So they'll be responsible for that. Upon installation, you know, the signs will be, at least the site will be at its original condition. And then also I think one of the main things was that there be a removal fund established if need be. So one thing I would like to point out on the map here, and I'll use my little laser from coaching here, but most of the signs are right here next to the bridge. Majority of the signs are here, and that's where we are trying to alleviate the concerns there, whether it be a obstruction of sight or is it next to a water line, bench, what have you. So the walkthrough was extremely helpful in that respect. But one thing to point out that I don't know if folks know, but it all goes down to Reach One Trail. So it's not just around the loop here, but Riverwalk, but continuing down. So, and a hats off to the real estate department for drafting up that proposal and getting it out the door in a timely manner. So I appreciate that. If there aren't any other questions, I can pass it over to Russ, and he can fill you in more details.
I've got a question.
Yes, Randy, go ahead, please.
One thing, on the picture back up on, I guess it's slide two, is that the way the sign will look? I like the looks of it.
Yes, that is a picture of Earth there you're looking at.
Right, and it's got the directions to go to Mars or go to Venus, which is really cool. In looking at the map, the last map that you had this morning, I'm curious, how long a walk will it be for my grandkids to go from the beginning to the end?
Well, I think that'll depend on if they want ice cream or not. You might have to hit the other side and then come back. But I'm guessing probably down and back, you're probably looking at roughly 3 miles or so.
Oh, that's just a good walk.
That's right.
That's great. It just looks marvelous in my eyes.
Well, if there's no other questions, maybe we could bring up Mr. Jones just to kind of explain from his end what he might think of the project and as far as timing goes.
I apologize. I won't be able to stay for the remainder of your meeting. I didn't get the memo department. I found out I have a new employee starting today, so I need to get back. It's been a pleasure working with the staff, and this process, I think, has been very beneficial in making sure that we produce a project that's going to be the best quality. And with the survey and staff concerns, there was concern about clutter and things kind of getting in the way visually. So shrinking the size down was a key factor, and going to more earth tone colors rather than the blue and the St. Louis model and stuff. Also, as you saw in the picture before, this will actually be a picture of the sun surface. And so it's all based on this 18-inch sun. Earth is that size in comparison. And the total model is a mile and a half long to get to the Kuiper Belt with Pluto and Sedna.
Question, Russ?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. Is that the sun? I figured it had to be the sun. Oh, and now I see the... But that, I wonder if there's a way to make that more clear.
I think with the photograph version,
it'll be clear that's more obvious. But it will show just a sliver of the sun above each one of the
right.
signs.
Yeah, so this is kind of the template. Signs will be.
Is that the actual size?
This is the actual size.
And when you said 4 feet, it'll the top of the sign will be at 4 feet?
Right about here. Yeah.
Right there. Okay.
Russ, you said that's the actual sign in your hands?
There is a typo on it.
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to see if you knew that.
Program we used for laying this out was just pretty distracting technically.
Being dyslexic, it looked perfect.
So the picture in the in your handout, I think, is the more accurate final version that we're going to be working on.
Yeah, just, grandparents' point of view, after our last meeting, when I got home, our youngest granddaughter, 8 and a half, was there. So I just kind of shared with her, what the discussion was and what the project was, and just said, is that something you'd be interested in doing? She said, yeah, but when? It was just anxious to go. So I think it's going to be a great educational tool. It'll provide opportunities for families to do things together and have conversation. And I think it's well thought out, and appreciate the staff working and, getting through the details. And thank you very much to all.
Comment?
More yes, comment? Commissioner okay. Congdon.
Russ, the main asteroid belt shown here, there a pretty good description about what an asteroid belt is?
Yeah, we're going to include some photos of actually recent shots of Vesta and one of the other asteroids. Just happens to be that there's a research center in Winthrop that has is operating one of the instruments on a spacecraft that went around those objects. And so we have the opportunity to get some pretty good photographs from them.
My only thought was if people are really concerned about too many signs and too much clutter, that might be one that could be left out in that area where there are so many of them. But just a comment. But I love it. I love the project. I think it's terrific.
Walk it again and take a look at it.
Was that the original path, or did it change from the original plan?
This is pretty much the original plan.
Okay.
But I would add that Mr. Jones was open to slightly moving some of the signage. For example, if it hit in the middle of a walkway, he was flexible with moving it a couple feet this way or that, which for maintenance for our staff is a great thing. So I appreciate that.
Great.
Good. Any other questions?
Hearing none, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Russ.
Once again, I really appreciate staff's assistance.
Yes, thank you, Russ. Great. Commissioners, if I could, just real quickly, I'd like to recognize Mr. Peterson, if you could come up here just real quickly. You may have heard that Mr. Peterson is taking on another role outside the district and has been willing to stick with us here for the next month while we try to replace him. He's been such an asset to our parks team, and he's going to be truly missed. So I just wanted to recognize him for his great work here at the district.
Yeah, well, thank you for the opportunity. And like I said at the beginning, it's the hardest part was the people, right? Why break it if it's not broke? So, you know, the first thing I noticed is just the quality of people, and that's really what I'm going to miss here. So everything from other departments, obviously the parks department, but everywhere else, I'm definitely going to miss that, and you guys as well in your efforts. So thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for your service, and good luck in your future.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mr.
Number six, large load.
Okay, so I want to talk about new large loads. And unlike most presentations, I'm going to take this one just because this affects so many parts of the district that there isn't a clear lead someplace in our different business units. And I want to take a fair amount of time on this one because this is a really big deal. There is a lot of money at stake on this one, probably one of the bigger issues that we're going to confront here. So want to begin to lay out for you a roadmap for how we're going to address loads greater than 5 megawatts. Remember that we have never had a load above 5 megawatts on our system, and that means that we're going to need to address pricing, terms, conditions for the three main elements of generation, transmission, and distribution. And each of those gets handled a little bit differently. I do want to say the reason this is so important is that our current rates are lower as a result of the wholesale revenue that we generate, and that coming back and being used as a, in effect, a subsidy for lowering our retail rates, and the straight substitution of what is currently a wholesale sale and turning it into a retail sale in large amounts, candidly, is financially unsustainable without rate increases, and probably pretty substantial rate increases. So it's going to be critical that we define the rules of the road for how we will deal with above 5 megawatt loads. Recall that when we put in place the high density load rate, it was for loads up to 5 megawatts. Many of those principles will likely be applicable as we move forward. But when you start to move to above 5 megawatts, the bigger the megawatts, the bigger the dollars, the bigger the dollars, the bigger the risk associated with it. So we really need to pay very close attention to how this will work. This will also cause us to begin to address a question which we have been saying we needed to address this year and next anyway, which is what does it mean when we say growth pays for growth, and exactly how are we going to apply that in different circumstances, and we will need to have policies with respect to that here because this is really large growth in effect. we recognize that there is a lot of support for economic development in the community and being able to use megawatts from the PUD to support economic development. But at the same time, we also know there are very different kinds of loads out there, and the community has different reactions to different types of loads. So we have everything from diamond foundry type load to Bitcoin type loads. And candidly, we're trying to figure out a policy that has to apply across the broad array of larger than 5 megawatt loads that we will be confronted with. Our goal today is to describe our conceptual thinking around pricing. We intend to begin to engage the large load applicants using this presentation. So we'll be looking for any feedback that you have about generally right direction or not. No decision is needed from the commission today. We're basically just trying to get into the right quadrant in terms of conceptually. And then we'll begin to engage with the loads, the potential loads, and find out what their needs are and find out how we match up. I do want to say this is a huge and substantial workload that was completely unanticipated. I think this is the second time you've heard me say this, and I'll warn you now, I'm going to keep saying it for our coming meetings, because we are going to have to figure out how we're going to manage all this, and it's going to be a combination of our own staff, and when we're using our own staff, then that will have an impact on the district performance plan that we were setting out to try to achieve for this year. And we are also looking at adding contract staff in order to be able to supplement the activity. Part of the reason for that is we don't know for certain how real these loads are. We could put a lot of time and effort into this and then find out that their expectations don't meet ours. And candidly, that work will then potentially go away. So we're trying to figure out how do we ramp up but be able to ramp down if needed along the way here too. So with that, I'm going to jump in and just say we do have a lot of requests, 7 different requests that we have. Have a lot of we're going to describe a little bit about what those requests are. We want to talk about what the risks are, because as you think about putting in place contractual mechanisms, contracts really, they define terms, but they're really about risk allocation. So we're going to describe what the risks are that we would be seeking to manage. This will not be a comprehensive set of risks, but they're the ones that we think are probably most important to you and to the community to make sure that we're thinking through how we will be addressing risk in contracts. And we'll talk about some of the options for managing those issues and risks and talk about next steps from here. We do have 7 requests. Loads range from a little bit more than 5 megawatts up to 100 megawatts. The combination of all those would double the total local average annual load that we have. So our 200 megawatts would basically turn that into 400. And what we're seeing is a lot of these folks are anxious to move forward quickly. They desire quick connections, and quick connections mean they want quick decisions. Quick decisions on all kinds of things. What will my rates be? How long will it take before I can get service? How much service can I get? All things that we've been trying to organize around. And this will be the first time, actually, we've begun to describe how we intend to address the requests and the types of conversation that we'll be having. A fundamental challenge that we have, and this is not true with all of the large loads, but we think with many of them, is a mismatch of business models. The requesters expect a short-term return on investment, in many cases less than a year. And we look at return on investment over the course of decades. So when you're dealing with months of ROI versus decades of ROI, and candidly, when you're in the electric utility business, you are always working in partnership, that the challenges here are trying to find the match between those different business models. The service requester's equipment can be mobile and transient, which means they may be here and then gone. And we've built infrastructure to be able to support them. We've also put in place contracts for power supply, or we've tied up power supply that otherwise might have been deployed into the market and created more value. These really are different from the kinds of things that we're accustomed to, whether it's anything from a fruit warehouse all the way up to an aluminum plant, where someone has made a large capital investment and made a commitment to the community. And therefore, when we're making a commitment in terms of infrastructure investment or tying up power supply, we're pretty confident that they're going to be around for a while to recover costs. And ultimately, that mismatch affects every part of our relationship. And so you'll see that as we begin to walk through this in terms of the types of concerns that we have as a result of that potential mismatch of business models. Things that we're going to have to manage, generation, transmission, distribution, and for those rates, terms, and conditions for each contract that we put in place. We have compliance issues that we will have to address potentially spill over into contract discussions, a variety of different risk considerations. Certainly the impact on our existing customer owners as a result of putting in place these contracts. And then at the same time, trying to manage to the concerns of being responsive to the request, because we do ultimately have obligation to serve. So if someone wants to come here, we do have an obligation to provide service to them, although the rates, terms, and conditions, we do have some discretion over. So let's begin to talk about the different types of risk. In the generation arena, maintaining the availability of large amounts of power supply for potential transient loans would significantly impact our current contract portfolio. So obviously we've got retail load, we've got long-term cost plus contracts, and then we have a variety of power that we sell into the market under different terms, but in general seeking to create highest value for the district. When we begin to move some of that load into the retail category, then it affects that contract portfolio. And when we do that, it ultimately affects our revenues. One of the things that might not be quite as obvious is when we have a fair amount of resource that we sell into the market, and we manage the risk for that by essentially shifting the risk of stream flow, outage, and credit to the purchaser. If you move that to a retail load, in general, the utility takes on that risk. So just that decision in and of itself begins to shift risk towards us and the rest of our customer owners. Now, there are ways to manage that, and we'll talk some about that along the way, but it is a fairly fundamental difference in terms of the types of contracts that we have in place today. There's a whole set of issues that, if you are a retail load, lead to a set of regulatory compliance and other issues that come into play. So, for example, the Initiative 937 requirements are based on the size of your retail load. So if you increase the amount of retail load that you have, then you also will need to increase your compliance requirements with respect to renewable resources, energy, and energy efficiency. We provide benefits to our low-income customers, in this case, low-income senior disabled customers, in terms of reduced bills. There's a cost associated with that. So if you've added to your retail load, you have to think about who will pay a share of those costs. And, of course, we offer a public power benefit program, and those costs are currently borne by our retail customers as well. So these are all things that come into play, and you'll see in a moment why, because we're going to show you some options for how we address generation and power supply, and while we'll need to think through those kinds of benefit programs and how we will get cost recovery for them. We potentially are going to have multiple contracts that might be of different forms, because I'll show you in a moment that we are at least considering giving customers choice as to the type of contract that they might sign. And if we're offering multiple contracts, then that workload issue that I described earlier is going to get even bigger. And it will get bigger not just in terms of putting the contract in place, but in terms of managing the contracts through time as well. So there will be costs potentially associated with that too. Okay, so let's talk now for a moment about options that we are considering to provide to potential purchasers. I do want to say right up front that we are thinking that it would make sense to provide customers choice, but that if we're going down this path, it would likely be a one-time choice, not a you get to choose the contract that you like today, and then you get to choose next year if you want a different one. Now, it could be for a term. You might get a contract for a term, and then you might have a choice after that term is up, although there would be no guarantee that the same options would be on the table when that term is up. So, again, thinking about the types of generation or power supply options that customers might have, we put them into four categories. The first is a cost of service type rate, which is consistent with the current high-density load rate that we offer. So remember, this is the below 5 megawatts. It's based on the production costs and any direct costs that we have. It considers the costs associated with increased stream flow and outage risk, but it does that because it's a variable rate. In other words, it's at the discretion of the commission to change the rate at any point in time. So to the extent that there are costs associated with low stream flow, outages on our system, then we can reflect that in our rates. It's not written into the terms of the contract the way other power supply options will be, as you'll see in a moment. Certainly, because of this mismatch of business models, we'll have a concern about trying to make sure that we have contract terms and that we match credit protection requirements with the contract term. There are a variety of ways of getting that credit protection, but the bottom line is there will need to be some assurances that, in fact, we're going to be able to recover the value that would be lost if a customer came and placed load on our system and then chose to depart for whatever reason. Again, the rate would be variable at the PUD discretion as the current HDL rate is. Now, that PUD discretion is subject to public process, so we would it's not that we can just walk in and unilaterally change the rate, tell you tomorrow. There'd be opportunity for public comment, an opportunity for the customer to be involved, but at the end of the day, it is up to the commission to decide what the rate will be. I think I've already mentioned that we would limit optionality during the contract term. Okay, so that's one option. Now we'd move to a second type of option, and again, these are built around contract models that you should be generally familiar with, because our goal here is to try to build off the existing foundation that we have, so we minimize the amount of work that goes into this, and we're not trying to create brand new models. So the second model is one that looks a lot like our current Alcoa and Puget contracts, where it would be a cost-plus slice contract. And by that, I mean it's based on production, direct and indirect costs. The purchaser would get a percentage output of the hydro project. Now, this is a different type of contract, because if you're getting a percentage output of the hydro project, that doesn't necessarily match up to your load. So you'll have to think about, so do I want something that is based on the output of the hydro projects and then having to likely create another type of contract, access to market or possibly a separate contract with us that would give you the type of retail load service that most people are accustomed to, which is you're doing all the balancing, you're making sure that the amount of power coming in is equivalent to the amount of power that I'm taking out. There'd be fixed terms and conditions, as there are in our current cost-plus contracts. And, of course, you're very familiar with those contracts because we've had a lot of discussion, certainly about Alcoa in the last couple of years, about how those work if someone wants to depart and the commitments that they're making in terms of assuring that certain types of costs will be covered. There's probably some flexibility with this type of contract. If you want to purchase the environmental attributes associated with our system, you could do so. Or you could leave them with us, and we'll sell them in the market. So there's a little bit more flexibility than there is with a traditional retail load contract. And we would have to find a way to make sure that because these would be retail loads, and this would be the distinction between an Alcoa Puget-type contract and this one, those are really wholesale contracts. This would be a retail contract. And so we'd have to make sure that we had ways to be able to recover for things like I-937 costs and public power benefits and other issues like that. The third option is, again, one that you should generally be familiar with, although it's not usually used at the retail level, and that's where we would just do a slice-type contract, and that's market rate-based. So different from the last one, and the last one was cost-based. This one would be market-based, so it's based on whatever the market value for power is. Again, it would be a percentage output of the hydro projects, just as our current slice contracts are. The customer will likely need, I would suspect, some PUD facilitated services or access to the market to meet all of their needs, again, to be able to match and get the balancing right so they're getting the amount of input of power that matches their load at any particular point in time. And as with the last type of contract, we'd have to have consideration for the other impacts, the I-937, public power benefit, the low-income subsidy programs. We'd have to have some recovery for that because these are, again, a retail contract. The final option is a market purchase, and we think of this generally as ultimately being a retail load as well, not a wholesale load. The terms would be established, though, in this case, between a power marketer and a customer, and they would be working with us. We'd be in that conversation all the way along the way, but basically they'd be buying from the market instead of buying for us for their energy supply. We would be part of that contract discussion, and ultimately, most likely, it would be a three-way contract, I assume. They would need some, probably need some services from us in order to be able to balance their load with the power supply. It's generally pretty difficult to buy from the market and be able to get that perfect all the time. Again, we'd have to have this consideration for other impacts like I-937, public power benefit programs. I do want to say this last one does give us some pause because it starts to look a lot like a wholesale contract, and there are some pretty significant regulatory issues associated with operating in the wholesale market versus the retail market, including the potential for Federal Energy Regulatory Commission oversight. And that gives us some pause, and I suspect that it will give the purchasers some pause as well. So there's a fair amount of work that would need to be done to make sure that we actually understand how this would come together and to be able to make sure that they are retained as retail loads. I'm going to pause there before moving on to transmission and distribution and see if we're doing okay to make sense. And
Steve, other than the possible FERC issues on number four, am I reading correctly that this would reduce the risk exposure to the largest amount given the four choices?
Assuming that you can maintain it as a retail load, then the answer to that question is yes. It does reduce the risk. Now, probably there's some risk that we would take because of we may learn more and change our minds on this, but at the moment it seems like it's probably a three-way contract, so we're involved in it in some fashion, which means we're incurring some of the risk. Anytime you're in a contract, you're incurring some of the risk. But the idea here was to move towards an option that minimized risk to the PUD by putting as much of that as possible in between the market seller and the retail purchaser.
Steve, so we really don't yet understand how this, how we would distinguish between retail versus wholesale marketing in this case.
It's not that I would say that we've done a lot of work and we understand it pretty well. It's just that we're not saying our knowledge is comprehensive enough that we're ready to say, so these are the specific things that would be necessary in order to make sure that it's a retail load.
It doesn't
and not a wholesale
roll over
load.
Into the wholesale.
Right. And Eric has got some really good work going on, and we've got some outside counsel help on that as well to make sure that we get this one right.
Thanks.
Okay. With that, we'll move on to transmission and distribution. So we're going to do this the same way we did generation. We're going to start with the risks, the things that we're concerned about, then we'll go to the options. And the options here are different in that we're probably not going to give customers an option between one or the other. We're probably going to have to pick one of them. So first of all, this really comes back in spades, the same issue that I discussed earlier, that we've got short-term contracts versus the potential needs for long-term infrastructure investments. So you've got a mismatch in terms of risk to cost recovery. This does require building beyond the requested size of load. So my technical term for this is transmission in particular is lumpy. It doesn't necessarily, as you add transmission, it doesn't match up to load very easily. So you make a change to transmission, it might add 50 or 100 megawatts of service, and you might only have a 20 megawatt load associated with that. So you've got this is going to be important in terms of the options we're going to present to you in a moment to understand this distinction that it's not easy for us to be able to say, well, just bring us the load and we'll size the transmission to meet it. We need recovery mechanisms for transmission study costs. So transmission studies can be expensive to accomplish, and we're not really interested in just doing a lot of transmission studies and incurring the cost of those when we're not certain whether someone is ready to actually take service. So it's a pay-as-you-go system where if you want us to take steps, then you'll need to pay for different levels of transmission studies. Again, we've got expectations around short turnaround time, while the studies and associated improvements are time-consuming. So transmission in particular is a difficult issue to address. The studies themselves take a substantial amount of time to accomplish, and then any infrastructure investment itself can be difficult to put in place, and as this board knows better than just about any in the state, building new infrastructure can be difficult in terms of siting. Then we've got the impact on just our existing workload of the things that that we need to get accomplished. So let's talk about transmission and distribution options. Most of this conversation is going to focus on transmission, I'm going to say, because it is possible to take service at a transmission voltage. And with these larger loads, it becomes more likely that someone would choose just to take at a transmission voltage and then move from there. But this can apply to distribution costs as well. Normally, with respect to the study part of this, the costs are paid in advance. It's a three-step process where you do an initial sort of quick feasibility reconnaissance level study, and you start to get more in depth with the second study, and then the third study gets specifically, here's what it would take in order to provide service, and here's what the cost associated with that would be. We're trying to find a way to be able to go faster because, candidly, we're concerned because we're not sure, I'm going to say it really bluntly, we're not sure how many tire kickers we've got. And we're not sure whether we've got folks who are saying, well, they might even have multiple requests for service in, or even if we don't have them today, we might see them in the future, where they're really only looking at one load, but they're trying different locations. And so when you've got that kind of situation, it'd be nice if we could do some triage. So we're working on that right now and assembling internal expert opinions for the step one, considering four regions in the county, basically North Wenatchee, Entiat, Malaga, and Monitor. The first three we have requests for service on. The fourth one we do not, but we may have some existing capability there, and so we're at least going to take a look at that because we know that that folks are going to ask us that question ultimately. And our goal is to be able to say, so roughly this is what it would take to provide service into each one of those areas, and that there will, we expect, be a pretty substantial difference in cost between those four regions. And ultimately, as you'll see, we expect to ask people to pay for the cost of these infrastructure investments. So they'll need to know that. Their big question for us is going to be, what's it going to cost me to get service? So we're giving you some options on the generation and power supply side, and we're going to be able to tell you something about what it will cost on the transmission side, and particularly location specific. Our goal, our next step after that is, once folks have taken a look and said, well, okay, now that I understand that, I think I might be interested in locating in location X, we might be able to cluster different applicants. And if we can cluster them, it creates two advantages. One, they share the cost of the study, so it makes it lower cost for them potentially. Two, we might actually be able to, if they bring this to fruition and actually get to a completion of a project, it probably is cheaper to locate them in one area than to have them locate individually spread across the county. So cheaper for them, cheaper, lower risk for us. So the idea of trying to get participants who are interested to try to locate in the same area just makes sense. So the next step two would be, let's try and figure out where these folks are interested in going. The timelines for this will be developed through the study process and a collaboration with requesters, and certainly many of them want to go fast. I would say in general, it's unlikely to be less than 2 years, particularly if system improvements are necessary. But there's an exception to every rule, and we've been looking at the North Wenatchee area, and it's possible we might be able to provide some service there in less than 2 years. So we're developing a very specific set of options. The Diamond Foundry has been in this queue for a while and been working with us, so we're ahead of the game on that one, and hopefully are going to be able to give them some options even in the next week or so with, again, this cursory level study of what it would take to provide service into different regions. Now, I do want to add, this is a new thought for us. We do not have on our system customer ownership of distribution facilities. And we've been asked to consider that, particularly with respect to the Diamond Foundry. And we've gone through and looked at this from our decision evaluation criteria, so all the different factors that we should be considering, financial, legal, public affairs, environmental, workload impacts. And our conclusion from that is that it may be possible for us to do so. There are some benefits associated with, in effect, privatizing a substation. Benefits in terms of they'd be able to be done quicker, and the capital would be put up by the customer, and therefore the risk is carried by the customer. So there's some pretty substantial financial advantages associated with that. But there are some pretty significant risks, too, risks that potentially could be managed through a contract. We are concerned that the folks who are thinking about this may not fully understand the operational issues that they're taking on. And probably as we begin to think through the contract issues, it'll become more clear the responsibilities that they would have. So there are risks of regulatory compliance. Any time you're operating systems that are part of the bulk electric system, you potentially are subject to the federal reliability compliance rules. And as this board knows, they are extensive, and they require a substantial amount of work. If they're operating in our balancing authority, we have responsibility for that. And so we will have to know exactly what's going on inside those substations, and we will have to have commitments from them in terms of the way that they will operate. Because you may recall that the fines are up to $1 million a day. So this is not child's play. This is serious stuff, and we would need commitments to make sure that we can meet all of our compliance requirements. There are safety issues, which are incredibly important. So it's an interconnected grid here. And so if you've got people working on systems inside substations, the impact of that is not necessarily limited to the substation unless the breaker is open. And if the breaker is open, that means there's no power flowing, and that means that facility is not operating at that point. So people generally don't want to do that. If they don't want to do that, then they're going to have to meet our safety requirements because it's not only their employees that are at risk, which we worry about them, but it's our employees who are at risk too. So there's some pretty significant issues there. And there are some issues associated with how you manage to make sure that you can safely provide reliability. So it has rarely, if ever, happened here, but if you had a disturbance on the system that required you to shed load, and there are rules around that, then we generally spread them out, or at least that's the way it would work. So we'd have to have some way of being able to spread out a shedding of load on a substation, which we're not operating at that point. Or we'd have to have financial compensation for not providing that load shedding. So some really significant issues that have to be addressed there. Again, we're open to having this conversation, but we want to make sure that people understand fully what they're getting into if they choose to go down this path.
So, Steve, if the private entity would build a substation and put it into use, and then that entity go away, what happens with the substation?
We would open the breaker, and it would sit there.
Okay.
So it's theirs. And if they're not operating and utilizing it, then that's their choice.
Okay.
And they deal with the decommissioning costs and whatever other issues are out there.
Okay.
Okay, what about pricing for transmission and distribution? So we have, fortunately, again, the 2+ years that we spent on high-density loads has really been helpful here because we're able to use that as a foundation for thinking through these kinds of issues. And while the high-density load really focused on distribution and not transmission costs, the principles are much the same. Two basic options for how we can do this. First, you'll pay our standard transmission and distribution rates. So you're benefiting from the system as a whole. You benefit from the fact that power flows, and therefore you'll pay transmission and distribution costs. The challenge here is with respect to what about the cost of upgrades? And when we start adding loads in the 5 megawatt and above level, we know that it's going to require some pretty significant infrastructure investments, particularly in the transmission arena. Two ways of going about that. First is I described earlier that transmission is lumpy. So let's say that you're a 20 megawatt load, but the transmission comes in 50 megawatt increments. At that point, we could either charge based on you will pay a proportional share of that 50-megawatt increment. So you'll pay upfront the cost of the new transmission requirements, but you'll pay 40% of the cost of that transmission. The remainder will be available for load growth and other uses and services. The alternative to that is no, you'll need to pay upfront the full cost. So you'll pay for the full 50 megawatts, even if you're only going to use 20. If we go down that path, as load growth occurs around there and begins to use that transmission, then we would probably provide credit. We would probably provide some credit back, basically. This is not unlike our current line extension policy, where we do this, where we say, if we need to build something big for you and you pay up front all of it, and there are latecomers, then the latecomers pay a fee in order to true up for the original cost. So again, we're going to have two choices here in terms of ways that we proceed here. This could be a substantial cost. So we could be looking at really pretty big dollars in terms of transmission investments, and the path here would not surprise me if our choice on this didn't make a difference in terms of people making a choice as to whether to locate here or not. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, so next steps. So we're seeking to develop a sustainable approach, and I would say particularly financially and legally sustainable approach, which addresses these loads of more than 5 megawatts. Again, we're trying to think through our tolerances for risk trying to make sure that as much as possible we can define for the community that whether there would be an impact on rates for existing customers, and if so, how much, and whether we want it to be no impact or not. What we're planning to do at this point is take this presentation and begin to meet with the current requesters to review the options that we've presented today, and from that begin to candidly get a better sense as to how serious they are. So if they know these are the things that we're thinking about, and these are likely minimum terms and conditions, is this something that they are still interested in generally being here, and specifically in the location they provided to us? From that, I think we can get a better sense and be able to bring back to you the kind of choices that we have and what the potential impacts are from the choices that we have. The timeline, and I know we get this question a lot, for existing requests is undefined at this moment. We love people want us to say, well, when will you tell us exactly? Well, we're in the middle of a big policy setting process that has pretty substantial financial impact to us, and this is going to be more iterative than just here it is, take it or leave it. Actually, we want to work with customers and try to figure out, here are the things that work for us, and let's hear what works for them, and be able to try to determine whether there is a match in terms of coming up with something that can create value in terms of more jobs in the community, and yet at the same time minimize the impact on our existing customers. And I'm going to say again, because I feel like I need to say it every time, really, really concerned about the workload impacts here. So it may turn out that we walk through this process and the list gets cold to some extent as a result of the locational issues, the price issues, the timeline issues, and the workload doesn't look as daunting as it could today with the trying to address the full array of customers who are in line. On the other hand, it could look even worse than it does today, because they like all the options and they want to pursue them all simultaneously. So I cannot say right now what the timeline impacts will be, and consequently can't really say what the workload impacts will be.
Steve, how many people do we have in process right now?
Seven.
And so we don't even really have a ballpark number for them.
Timeline? No, I don't think that we do have one for them. I will say that the Diamond Foundry is kind of breaking the ground here, and they're further along because they've been around and been working with us for longer. So I think we're beginning to develop some answers for them in terms of transmission. They are among those who have expressed an interest in a privatized substation, so we're beginning to develop some answers for them about here's what it might look like, and again, trying to make sure that they understand the obligations that they'd be taking on if they want to go down that path. The fact that they're breaking ground is helping us.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that we have been through the high-density load has, again, created a strong foundation for us. The fact that we're working with Diamond Foundry is helping us to understand the types of issues that will apply to all these types of loads. On the other hand, the fact that we have all these types of loads is also somewhat making the Diamond Foundry a little bit more difficult, because we're realizing the precedent that's being established as we make these decisions. around the Diamond Foundry.
What kind of commitment are we getting from folks like these who are jumping into the process and we're committing time and dollars and are we getting any commitment from them up front?
Up until now, these have been basically conservation or conversations, excuse me. And so we have not asked them for a dollar commitment. We're about to change that. Probably in the next couple of weeks, we'll be making a change to that and beginning to ask for $1,000, $2,000, something like that to even have these conversations because they are taking time, mm-hmm. taking time and resources mm-hmm. for us to be able to have them. And the problem is that when it's free, people can ask for a lot. And if there were no lost opportunity cost, that might not be a problem, but it is a lost opportunity cost because mm-hmm. we have a big program of things we're trying to accomplish for the county. And we need to make sure that there's a recognition that there's value being lost here, the more conversation that we have.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Anyone else? Randy?
Okay. Nope, not here.
All right. So Steve,
I do have one question.
Okay, please.
So in these next steps, how is that different than just a straight moratorium that says, unless you've broke ground, we're not doing anything else until these steps are defined?
Well, I think it's a different signal that's being sent. Moratorium tends to tell people that there's a risk that nothing may happen for a period of time. On some of these, we may be able to move forward. Again, we're further along with respect to the Diamond Foundry than we are with the other options that are on the table. So this actually allows us to be able to move forward on at least some of the transactions. You could craft a moratorium in lots of different ways. You could say the moratorium is we are not going to sign a contract for service until some date. Or you could say we're not going to sign even a willingness to do transmission studies until some date. So moratoriums have a range of options associated with them. I think where we are right now is we're just trying to move things through and get what we can done and put things in place. So I would see those as different in that way. Moratorium says nothing's going to happen until some date certain, and we're trying to move them forward as best we can. I'm not sure from the perplexed look on your face if I answered your question.
No, I mean, it just takes me to my next level of questions, but thank you.
Commissioner Arsenault?
Steve, do we have any measurement of rate sensitivity of this particular group that are asking for consideration?
The problem is there are different kinds of loads and there are different kinds of businesses operating in different markets. So if you start with the Diamond Foundry, they're operating in a diamond market, and that would be different from a Bitcoin miner. Probably more of these loads are likely on the cryptocurrency in terms of the megawatts that we're talking about here. So in there, yes, we've looked at generally what does it take in terms of the amount of the cost of power relative to the value created by cryptocurrency. But the difficulty is the volatility in that cryptocurrency price is so substantial right now that you can't pin it like you could to an aluminum price where, the aluminum price is volatile, but it moves 20%, 30%. These hundreds, if not thousands, percent change in Bitcoin prices don't give us anything to peg to say, well, at that amount, then it's clear that it works or it doesn't work. So I guess the basic answer is for the majority of the load that's requesting service, we don't have a good answer for that one right now.
Do we know whether the power rate is the sole attraction, or does our area, does our county have something else that is an attraction for this group?
So we think there are a couple of things. Certainly power rate is likely the most likely, but our fiber system is pretty darn good, and the fiber system is important for a lot of these folks, and our climate is relatively important as well. So the opportunity to provide cooling through natural climate is an advantage. But power is the big one as far as we can tell.
Do you think power alone would push these entities out of consideration for this county?
I don't know the answer to that. I think if I knew the answer to that, I could probably answer more quickly what the timeline is
going
to be.
Right, and that's kind of where I was going. If there's a perceived value beyond power, does that factor into then the way we would structure a rate?
I think the only way we're going to find that out is through having these conversations, and that's why the iterative process is going to be important to us.
Thank you.
Other questions? You know, I have one that's related to risk and capacity. You know, last night was 11 degrees. Our system gets tested pretty thoroughly at zero, almost an annual event. So when we're at zero, is that a consumption? And I've got some experts out here I can eyeball. Is that around 400 megs when we're at stressed at around zero?
Want to answer, Chad?
Chad Risman, Director Distribution Asset Management and Engineering. So this morning we peaked at, when we were at 11 degrees, I actually didn't look at the temperature, but we peaked at 420 megawatts.
Okay. So.
And last year when we were at zero?
We're 500 to 600 megawatts in that range.
So.
500, excuse me.
Okay. So we need to just to take care of our needs, our residential needs, other needs, we need to have at least a capacity of 500 megawatts locally. Would that be a fair assumption? Okay, so then I guess my question goes on from there. In terms of megawatts that we already have contracts for and obligations, and this could go, I guess, probably more to Greg, you know, what is our daily requirement January 3rd when it's 0 degrees and we're having demands from contracts that we've already sold? So you take the 500 megawatts for 0 degrees, you take the contracts that are that we're committed to, and take a look at the number of turbines that we have available due to repair and replacement. And you add all that up, what capacity do we have to serve loads of 50 to 100 megawatts and not run our system at risk? Does that make, is that enough questions in the, in there to answer that? And do we have that? Because I think we're about, what, 1,200 a day? In terms of what we generally produce or can produce, boilerplate around 2,000.
So I think the let me go to your basic question. So we have peak and energy demands on the system, and we manage for those. Certainly, if we were adding these large amounts of load, it's going to change our portfolio of sales. Right, yeah. That's the simple way of putting it.
Right.
And we'd need to get the timing right on that.
Yeah.
So we'd need to think about. If we were going to add that much load, are we going to reduce the amount of slice sales? And which slice sale are we going to take off? And at what point are we going to make that go into effect? We always have options to buy from the market to cover in a time when we're short. And we'd want to think through the cost of that relative to if we were doing a buyback on an existing contract, for example, what the cost of that would be. Those would be all part of the discussion, ultimately, that fits into your generation power supply contractual discussion. So there's a transition period that we'd have to work through, for sure, and there'd be some costs associated with that.
And I guess, to me, there is some risk involved in this in terms of maintenance and operations and contract sales that are beneficial to our financial portfolio. And I guess, so there's kind of a series of questions in there that causes me concern. And you know, I don't want a necessarily a significant commitment of staff time, but I would have a greater degree of comfort if I had some kind of an idea where we are in that whole realm of commitments, reserve capacity, capacity to be able to take turbines offline, do appropriate repair work, et cetera. You know, just kind of, I just don't want to put us in a position where we jeopardize our ability to meet our current commitments, particularly locally and to contracts we have in place.
So that's information we can provide to you. So okay. What part of what we're looking at is how do you match up the sales that we would make with our current generation portfolio, the timing of that too. So it's certainly part of our consideration. We can bring that back to the commission.
Yeah, because when I look at our bottom line from last year and this year, we're doing well, considering where the market is. Yeah, just don't want to jeopardize that. So, and then just so you have an understanding, at least where this is this commissioner is coming from, I appreciated Steve McKenna's question, you know, related to a moratorium that, you know, I want to make sure that we're giving ourselves time without spreading our staff so thin that we're not being attentive to other issues while we're being attentive to this one, because our staff are certainly busy enough, you know, without adding an additional thing on. And I don't necessarily want to be involved in answering all of these questions at the risk of not being attentive to other things that we also have already established as a priority. So just some concerns.
So what?
Yes, Randy.
You know, as a follow-up to what you just said and Steve McKenna, I guess it's question for our management is, would in fact some form of a moratorium buy them space to be able to do a more effective job on this whole on what's facing us?
So I'd like to take that as one for consideration and do some advantages and disadvantages for you, because I can see some on both sides. There are some challenges it would create for us in terms of carrying through on our existing commitments. So that gives me some pause. On the other hand, when trying to do that, it's going to engage us in a lot of these more difficult issues too.
Yeah.
So how about if we take that one away and give that one some thought, so we make sure it, you get a considered discussion of that and not an off-the-cuff reaction.
Mr. Conger.
If Randy's finished.
I'm finished.
Thank you, Randy.
And add on to that, how this would work if we have a moratorium in place by the city of Chelan, potentially by the county, by the city of Wenatchee, then where does that put the PUD? I don't know how those are going to fit together, or if they will. I don't know how that would affect us.
I would let our learned general counsel respond to that.
I think any Commissioner Eric Balquist, General Counsel, I think any of the – so all of the different municipalities have different authorities and different purviews for what they're managing and regulating. And I think we would in terms of other municipalities that have potentially interposed moratoriums, I've heard of two at least at this point that I'm aware of. Certainly we don't control their timeline. I know that we're working with them to give them information be looking for information. Any moratorium action that we would take separate and apart from that would be just that. It would be separate and apart. There would have to be...
How do you separate them out? I don't understand that. I mean, is it based on the geographical location?
Well, so...
Moratorium here?
Well, so from the city or municipality's perspective, they only have jurisdiction within their borders.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I've heard that the city of Chelan might have taken some action.
They
so
have.
That would only control... permitted uses probably under their zoning code within the city limits of Chelan. Ours would be countywide, theoretically. There's potentially some optionality for the board in that. But, in order, you'd have to explore, you know, each municipality and what the conditions mm-hmm. of their moratorium on. And as Steve mentioned earlier, you can have different criteria for moratoriums. You'll recall that our last moratorium was on accepting applications. So, you know, we could, as Steve suggested, accept applications but not connect. We could continue to study but not agree to sell. So we have optionality, as do the munis there. So the municipalities, they come at it, I think, from a little bit different perspective. They have authority that we don't related to public health, safety, welfare, and also with respect to their charters for community development and zoning and business licensing and so forth. We don't have that authority as a PUD. So the only way you would end up siting, maybe the ultimate answer to your question is, the only way a new load would end up siting in a location, there would have to be no moratoriums from any municipality that would prevent it.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's potential that either a municipal moratorium or a PUD moratorium would stop a siting.
So one doesn't really override the other.
No, I think they are. Yes, if that's your question, no. I think that they're relative to the authorities of the differing municipalities, and they're, think of them as concurrent. They both would be in place and both pose a potential barrier to siting a new load.
Yeah, because that was a question a couple of the Chelan City Councilmen asked. If we do have this moratorium and the PUD doesn't have the moratorium, then how who has the authority?
Yeah, so certainly
complicated, obviously.
Well, certainly the municipalities have the authority within their own jurisdictions to issue things like building permits or approve the siting of businesses within their zoning code, right? And we don't have those available to us. Ours really comes down to term and condition of service, protection of our system, protection of our finances, including our existing rates and rate pressure on those. So both are discrete and different. Both pose potential barrier to siting a new load. In order to site a new load, it would be similar to any business that comes to Wenatchee and wants to open a shop. They're going to have to come to the PUD for service and sign up for that service under, and whether it's large or not, a service mm-hmm. under our service regulations. But they're also going to the city and applying for a business license and make sure they're paying the appropriate fees, make sure they're proposing to site within a zone that is, you know, permissible for that type of proposed use. They have to clear both just as they would in a moratorium.
In the county.
Potentially the county as well, yes. Potentially the county as well, depends upon the jurisdictions, right?
Once all this is in
place. That's exactly right. So it's just another box to check as you're trying to prepare a new proposed use.
And then just one last
sure.
question.
Sure, no, please. I think this is important enough.
So, Steve, so obviously you have a team. Is this like the senior team, a team of, you know, John and Chad and legal transition generation all working together? I can see that it's really important.
We do, although I was going to also say in response to Commissioner Bowles' question a moment ago, we're going to be restructuring some to manage this issue because it has tentacles all the way throughout the district, and trying to figure out how we're going to create a leadership team that focuses on this issue, because there's so much at stake here, mm-hmm. to make sure that we've got that pulled together. And we're, like I say, going to bring in probably some contract resources, use some of our internal resources, make sure we've got clear lines of responsibility associated with that. I'm hoping actually that we'll have an outline of that for you for the next meeting. Because as we do that, it also begins to tell us where the impacts in the organization are going to be with respect to our existing performance plan. Okay, so if those are the people that are working on this, then get a sense of what work they're doing. And while, again, we may not be able to say, is this X number of hours versus Y number of hours of work, we're going to at least have a sense of who the people are and therefore the impact on specific projects.
And you know what else? I'm trying to think how I'm looking at Dennis's question, and that would be really helpful to have something like, you know, how you present us with the expected case, mm-hmm. and usually related to financial issues, but the expected case, and then I'm trying to think the stress case, or I forget what the language is around that. But if we had the expected case on a normal day, and then the stress case where we have the low temperatures, we have this amount of energy that's committed here and here, and then we could get the most stressed scenario case and what that leaves us with in terms of reserves. And I don't know if that would be a way to approach it, but
sure.
But that's been helpful before when we're looking at the financial structure of things.
Mm-hmm. Yep, makes sense.
Yeah. And I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I'm going to do it a little bit more. two things. At some point, we reach capacity. The related question is, where is that capacity line? And, then once we hit capacity, what is our, and this maybe this would be an Eric question, once we hit capacity of our own system, the options are, that's it. Or do we consistently then purchase off the market to meet those loads? And do we have the authority to say, here's capacity. We can't serve beyond that. I don't know. So
if you put a pin in that question, I'm happy to talk to you about that offline.
Okay, perfect. And then again, fiber capacity, and that would be a Mike Coleman question. As more and more servers come online, does our system, in terms of fiber, have the capacity to handle that size of loads in multiple locations? And so, then what's the cost associated with that? Bottom line is, I'm a worried man. Help me understand this.
Okay. Those are good questions that we can provide follow-up on.
This is really helpful, though.
It is.
It's a great start for me, anyway.
Sorry, well beyond the time that I know you like to allot to a single agenda item, but I think it is an important one.
I'm not sure there's a whole lot that we have to talk about that would trump this.
And I think this circles back to item number 4 in terms of generation options, where market purchase, from listening to our discussion today, it is very appealing to me that we insulate our own production generation of power, and certainly market purchase would be one avenue that would allow us that insulation, address some of the issues of selling all of our own generation, and yet leaving a door open for this type of economic development in the county, but doing so at a price point that may or may not be attractive to those that want our power. So that circles back to the question earlier, is are there other elements that are attractive to these users besides the price they pay for power that would still bring them to our county?
Right. Yeah. Fair question.
Something that just popped
in. I guess I posed.
I'm sorry, Randy. Please go ahead.
Well, based on the discussion that's been ongoing, I pose a question, I think, to Eric or Steve. Don't we, by law, no matter what the load is, have an obligation to serve?
So if you'll put a pin in that, I'm happy to discuss it with you offline. I don't want to give legal advice here in open session.
All right.
Just a question, too. I think, and I don't know the answer, but if we end up purchasing in the market, the electricity we produce and sell and market is green and has value because of it. If we purchase in the market, do we erode the value of our own product by mixing, and I know there's a modest amount of it that if we don't do, we get basically assessed by the state board anyway, but are we kind of violating the value or devaluing our green value because we would purchase offline and mix fuel sold through us and erode our green value?
I think, as with a lot of things, we have options for how we would address the power supply that we would provide, including whether we're selling environmental attributes or not. and whether we're purchasing environmental attributes or not. So the answer to that question is it depends. It depends on the contract and the terms that we write. So I believe, though, that the direction that I feel like we're operating under from the board is that we want to maintain the value, the environmental value of the existing hydro system for our existing customers. So that part seems fairly clear to me.
Yeah.
And so I'm comfortable that we're thinking about how we would do this in a fashion that minimizes the risk there.
So the answer is we can control that. We manage that.
I think we do have a lot of options in terms of how we manage that through a contract.
Yeah. Thanks.
Any other thoughts or questions for Mr. Wright today or staff who are present? Really good presentation. Lots of good questions. I feel a little better, but marginally. Yeah. No, this is a serious issue, and I appreciate the time being taken on it.
Okay. Shall we go to agenda item 7?
8?
7, I think, actually, is our carbon update.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. No, I just inadvertently skipped.
I'm going to invite Greg Carrington, Tracy Yunt, to come up and provide an update on all things carbon.
So, Dennis, can we characterize this as out of the frying pan and into the fire?
Yep. One heat mark to a next one.
I was trying to figure out how that relates to carbon some way, but
yeah.
Couldn't come up with something.
I was trying to figure out something clever, but
I was trying to apply the safety minute and do a situational awareness right now. Good morning, Tracy.
It's an interesting time, I can share that. It's probably the most interesting since I've been a commissioner.
It is very interesting. Good morning, Tracy Hunt, Director of External Affairs.
Greg Carrington, Managing Director of Energy Resources.
Sorry about that. All right, so we're going to go through a little background on the E3 study today, talk about the impact of carbon pricing on the district, and then hit in a little bit on the legislative proposals. No decisions need to be made today. So background of the E3 study, we partnered with, as part of the public generating pool, to hire E3 to help us develop a tool to understand the impacts of carbon policies on the electric sector, looking at costs, how do policies compare to each other, what does it do, what do these policies do to the energy portfolio in the Northwest, and what are maybe some of the unintended consequences of policy. So this is, it's really, we created a functional model where you take the inputs, and these little pictures on the side are like just assumptions and different resources that are available. And then we have this computer-based model that we then input from the bottom these policy constraints, so a different policy scenario, 1 through 5. So with these inputs and the model and what you're looking to answer, it'll then give you some outputs related to what are the emissions, what are the costs, will the system be reliable, and then what resources are needed. So it is a functional model that we base this initial study on. So the base case is interesting in that these are all the policies that are in place now. So we just did, what if we did nothing from here forward? What would the model tell us? And it includes coal retirements and the conservation measures from the 7th power plan and existing policies. And as an aside, the current policies would put us at about a 91% GHG-free resource portfolio in Washington, Oregon. That's the footprint of the study, Washington, Oregon, Northern Idaho, Western Montana. So that's a good starting number with the current policies. This next slide begins to show some of the outputs of the model. Just to orient you, on the left is the cost of greenhouse gas abatement, dollars per metric ton. And across the right, on the bottom, are the greenhouse gas emissions. And again, this is for the geographic footprint of the area. So if you were to, if the state of Washington was to decide to develop a no new gas policy, you would essentially be looking at $600 a metric ton, and you would get about 3 million metric tons of emission reductions. So you start to see the cost versus the benefit for each of these scenarios.
So the you can think of the width of these bars as being the effectiveness of that measure at reducing carbon. So if it's narrow, it's not very effective from a carbon mitigation perspective. And if it's high, I mean, the height of it is that means it's a big cost. Okay. So no new gas would fall into the category of not being very effective and very costly.
The next slide, we kind of call this affectionately the killer graph, because it takes the policy scenarios that were analyzed, the no new gas policy, a renewable portfolio policy, a price on carbon policy, and it compares those to, the cost and how far along this efficient frontier we work. So if you look at the green, the 40% reduction, the 60% reduction, the governor's tax and the legislative tax and the 80%, those were scenarios chosen before the current pieces of legislation were in front of us. So this is from last year. And basically what you're seeing here is along that continuum between the 40% and the 80% reduction, what it shows is that is the most efficient pathway, which is the lowest cost with the highest reduction of carbon emissions based on the E3 study assumptions. So that's kind of the efficient frontier, so to speak.
Tracy?
Yes.
On this graph, where does the baseline fall?
Okay, so the baseline, these are all incremental costs. So the 0-0 represents all policies that are in place today. So there are costs associated with that, but this study is looking at, all right, so if we use today's policies as the starting point, all of these dollars are incremental to what's in place today.
So that is the baseline.
That's right. The 0-0 is the baseline.
Yeah.
And one thing I want to point out, it's hard to see on this, but there's actually a line connecting the green dots going up there, and you can see it better on the screen there. Your handouts, it makes it really hard to see. But that's, as Tracy was saying, that bottom graph that goes and connects the green dots is probably the most efficient, least cost pathway to getting to 80% reduction. Interestingly, the 80% seems to be the inflection point where if you go beyond the 80%, you start to go up exponentially on cost. So the cost benefit starts to go down dramatically past that 80%.
So some of the findings, we've got a couple, 8 bullets of findings here. And what we found was the most cost-effective opportunity to reduce carbon is really to replace coal with energy efficiency, renewables, and natural gas. And that'll transition over time. But the low-hanging fruit is replacing coal. We also found that natural gas is critical for flexibility. That's one reason why this no gas policy is so expensive. We need the natural gas to cover those days where we have 0 degrees and where we don't have a lot of water in the river. We need to be able to fire up thermal generation.
And we're talking gas peakers here, not baseload gas. So you're talking about the type of thing that can be fired up and integrate wind and solar into the system and fire up when needed. That's the type of gas we're talking. That's the reason why we use the term flexible capacity and not just the capacity.
Okay, so a dollar-wise figured in to the study, are there dollars figured in for creating, maintaining that gas capacity?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it the model, the Resolve model, will look at your entire portfolio and choose the least cost pathway forward, you know, and assuming access to natural gas, assuming access to wind and solar and hydro and all of that. It'll go in there and choose the least cost pathway.
Additional renewable resources are also needed over the long term through 2050. So we're going to need more renewable resources, especially as or if other sectors such as transportation start to electrify, and the load would grow commensurately. We found that efficient frontier, those are typically referred to as a cap and trade or a carbon tax approach, and they are much more efficient than a renewable portfolio standard. because they're actually putting a price on the carbon. Prohibition of new natural gas had significant costs. Again, that was the first red band you saw. Another interesting one, and one that's important to us, is existing zero carbon resources are extremely valuable. Essentially, what the model showed, we ran some sensitivities, some scenarios. What if you took off a couple thousand megawatts of hydro and maybe combined with nuclear? What it essentially did is said you would have to replace those 2,000 megawatts with 6,000 megawatts of wind and 2,000 megawatts of gas.
Just stay to the 2,000.
Just to replace the 2,000, which adds an incremental cost of over $1.6 billion a year. So that provides a real incentive for folks to reinvest and make sure the existing GHG fleet is available.
So you can do the math real quickly. So you can think of wind and solar being about 30% available most of the time. So you take the 6,000 divided by 3, you end up with 2,000 megawatts of capacity. Then you need that 2,000 megawatts of the flexible gas in order to back it up. And that's where that's where the math comes out.
So on number 6 is the utilizing wind and solar, is that with or without subsidy, the cost?
Generally speaking, it's without subsidies.
Okay. Does that
exist? And we actually looked at it both ways.
Yeah. Does that exist without?
Yeah, it is more and more. You know, in the past that hasn't been true, but because the gas and wind and solar have been decreasing as a result of the research and development, their dependency on subsidies is decreasing, and the subsidies are starting to dry up somewhat.
Okay. It also considers the transmission requirements that would be needed.
Thank you.
A couple more things. We're going to need more energy efficiency measures, so additional research and development. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the last one, vehicle electrification is a low-cost measure for reducing emissions. That's where a lot of the emissions is, most of the emissions in our area.
Okay, so now what is the impact to the PUD on the various proposals that are out there? Tracy will highlight what those are, but you all know there's a carbon tax bill, and there's also a talk about a renewable portfolio standard. So when we talk about carbon and reduction carbon, Tracy was referring to that lower line, which is the most efficient pathway to achieving carbon. I add, whenever I look at this, also price formation and the most efficient pathway from a market, you know, and how the market is going to react to it. And so on the carbon tax bill, what that does from a price perspective is that it has a tendency to increase the value of our portfolio, and then how much can we get in the market as it increases the price, and the price formation is actually responding to market signals. We would expect that in the early years when the price of carbon is low, that we would see somewhere between a zero and a $3 million value to the PUD during those years. And as the price increases beyond that, we would expect to see somewhere between zero and $6 million. The reason that the zero is there is because I can't predict how the market would react to a carbon tax or a cap and trade. I do know that I have access to the California market, so if the market in Washington State didn't form in the right way, we would continue to sell our portfolio to marketers that then sell it into California, and the impact to us would be zero.
Greg, is that the annual?
That is the annual.
It is?
Yes.
Yeah,
that's right. The impact on the renewable portfolio standard, I would not consider it to be the most efficient way of sending price signals to the market. It basically is telling us what to do as far as lowering carbon rather than turning, you know, coal off. It's basically mandating that you go out there and build more wind and solar. It causes us to overbuild. When you overbuild, you end up getting negative price signals, and if you get supplemental type of benefits associated with that, it even becomes more distorted. So when I look at it from a price formation, I don't consider that to be the most effective or the most efficient way of moving forward. All of the benefits that we're talking about that we would have gained from a carbon tax bill would be negated by a renewable portfolio standard of 30%. I think we lose about 11% on the forward price curves at 30%, and we lose about I think 56% when you get to a 50% renewable portfolio standard, because we're already at, you know, 90% renewable in the state of Washington. Building more is not an effective way of doing that.
So what we've been working on is creating tools to help us understand things, right? So we worked with PGP and E3 to create the Resolve model. Greg and his group goes and evaluates these proposals as they relate to our bottom line and these annual impacts. So this is all in an effort to inform decision makers and inform folks on what are these scenarios going to potentially do to Chelan PUD. So here is a suite of legislative items as well as a couple of initiatives that I updated even this morning. They're kind of in three categories. One is you have the carbon tax bill that's largely in play right now, that was a governor-sponsored bill that's now oversaw by Carlisle. And this is the $12 to $30 tax, and it's economy-wide. Then you have the next three bills. I have this line over on the left there, the arrow up and down. These three bills are in a state of flux. In fact, two of them were re-released this morning at 5:30, or I got copies at 5:30. And so we're digging into them. That's why some of this is grayed out a little bit, because it's potentially in a state of flux. But these are energy sector specific, looking at tax breaks potentially, but they're setting standards of 100% clean or changing the renewable portfolio standard. And then you can see HB 2283, they're drafting a striker, and I have no idea what it will or won't say. I haven't got any idea yet. So these are three that are in play that the legislature is considering as an alternative potentially to the governor's carbon tax bill. Then the third category are the initiatives down below. And again, we don't really know what these are going to have in them, one, the Alliance for Clean Energy could be similar to 6203, but it has some differences such as being load base, maybe a higher tax and fee rates. Again, I'm just guessing right now. We'll have to see when it's actually made available. And then there's another one from Climate Solutions that's our assessment is right now it's unlikely to evolve, but it could be based on 6253, which is 100% clean. So we have a tax bill that's been discussed quite a bit with stakeholders, a lot of involvement. We have these other three bills that have had limited involvement. They're under a state of flux right now. And then we have initiatives that some people believe are being held in the event that legislation doesn't happen. That doesn't mean there couldn't be some combination of a smaller bill, maybe less inclusive in combination with an initiative. I think the initiative drafters are waiting in some respects to see what happens with the legislation. So we've got a couple more weeks. I didn't get the final date, but we've got a couple more weeks where these bills are in play, and we are obviously engaged with them every day.
Okay. Questions, comments?
Tracy, what is a striker?
They're basically keeping the number and then throwing the rest away, and then rewriting the bill. And we expected some major changes in these other bills, for example, and we haven't been able to see the real difference. So we don't know if we're going to be getting something that's 95% the same or 95% different, but it could look quite a bit different just with the same number.
Thank you.
Other comments or questions?
So, Tracy, you might want. Did you talk about what the timeline is? When do all of these bills need to get done?
Yeah, so we've got a couple more weeks of session, these are considered necessary to implement the budget, any of the tax-related bills. So we could see something happen today. We could see something happen in 2 weeks. At the beginning of the session, there was a high degree of certainty that there would not be an executive or a special session. I don't know that there's really any discussions for there to be a special session, but that would be what would have to happen for us to continue on past a couple of weeks, past the session deadlines.
A question on 6253, and I know it's been grayed, so there's, you know, some different considerations. But the elimination of fossil fuels by 2045, is that including transportation?
No, these are electric sector only.
Electric sector only.
And in one part, this bill said it eliminates coal, but it would still have an availability to use gas. Again, I'm going to have to take a look. So there was some differences, but there was a timeline established for those. 25% reduction, a 50% reduction, and ultimately 100% reduction over time.
Okay. So continuing kind of on that same pathway a little bit, Centralia, does it completely shut down 2025?
There has been talk about refueling Centralia, so, but I don't know whether that's viable or not. So they were talking about converting it into a gas peaker.
Okay.
But it supposedly is shutting down from a coal burning perspective.
Okay. In about 2025.
Steve, do you remember the date?
Yeah, I think there's different units, so it's between 2020 and 2025.
Okay. And then, so that the electricity generated there goes out of state, but the carbon remains here. So how's that calibrated?
Yeah, I think it can be used. They negotiated when they had the settlement the ability to use gas in the market, and it can stay within the state if they wanted it to. It's not considered to be there's no carbon liability because of the fact that it's a settlement agreement that will be done by 2025. So they're considered to be no carbon liability at this time for that project.
Okay. Other thoughts, questions?
So, Dennis.
Yes.
At some moment in time, and I know Steve is probably going to talk about this, we need to talk as a commission about where we are on things that that go beyond the electric sector. And I'm looking specifically right now at the Carlisle bill, which puts a carbon tax throughout the economy, and it doesn't speak just to the electric sector. How do we as a commission approach that? I know I have my own strong personal opinions, which you've all heard.
True.
But when do we have that discussion?
I'm going to default to Steve, at least at least momentarily.
So I think at the moment we don't have one scheduled, and the issue is as this moves forward over the course of the next week or so, does the commission have a need to have that conversation? And if so, then we could schedule a special session of some kind. It's just not clear at the moment where these bills are going, and if they require us to have that conversation, I think is what it comes down to.
Yeah.
It may be, I don't know if Commissioner Smith has expressed his view on the record. He may want to express his view at this point. I think many of us are familiar with it, but in terms of the commission engaging that conversation today, we are not feeling a need that we have to come to a conclusion in order to be able to engage the conversation in Olympia.
Go ahead, Randy, please.
Well, I will publicly express my thoughts that we as a commission, looking at what's best for the utility, need to look at the study that was done that spoke strictly to the electric sector. And while I have shared openly that if any legislation was affecting only the electric sector, I could support taxing carbon on the electric sector, but going beyond that is not a step that I would go. I could not support beyond the electric sector.
My thoughts, Randy, related to that is that I think you're always better off to work with what is within your span of control. If not, you know, and this commission's span of control is, I think, dealing with what we produce and how we distribute it. I think if we start getting into issues as an example of transportation, you know, then do you look for, you know, an agricultural exemption? Do you look for public transportation exemptions? I mean, you know, so then you start getting into areas that we have very little or no control over. And I think we keep our nose cleanest by staying with the electric sector. Other people have, I think, an obligation to step up and deal with their sector. And then it could be, and Eric, I would want to use the right term, that when you file for a friend of the court.
Amicus.
There we go. We could do something similar if we felt strongly about something that, you know, would affect our ratepayers in a positive sense. But you might be a little surprised this morning, but I pretty much agree with you, Randy. So that's worth that's worth the conversation later.
Now I'm really unclear.
Yeah, but that's going to cost you a drink.
I don't know. We need to. I need to understand this better. I mean, in terms of the dynamics of the commission and whether it's important to have that public discussion, and because we are not going to take any action.
No.
And
not that I see anyway.
So. Is it important that we have a discussion to determine who sits where and when, I'm really unclear now where we are and where we're going, but I guess that will evolve.
Yeah, and I think it's, if you look at how many changes took place over the weekend, there's going to be about, I think, 2 weeks of non-clarity with kind of a hustled thing at the end.
There continues to be change. We're trying to figure out which of these proposals, not which, but how each of these proposals impact the PUD. Now, obviously, as you stated, the Carlisle bill, which is economy-wide, has broader implications outside of our analysis capabilities. But we're still analyzing it as relates to what are the impacts of Chelan PUD, and we're doing that for the broad bill as well as the electric sector specifically. So as we get more details of what these bills look like, we'll have a better sense. Going back to the E3 study, there are some themes about what does a price on carbon do, what does a renewable portfolio standard change do, a price on or a limitation of gas. So we're using those criteria or those components of the E3 study to assess all of these proposals. If there is a limitation on natural gas, for example, what does that translate into meaning for us in the market?
Yeah. But so that's certainly within the electric sector.
Yes. So we're looking at all of them from an electric sector perspective.
Thank you.
So the way you could look at it is as the bills are produced, we can figure out where it falls on this continuum of being effective for.
It's probably going to have more to do with passing any of these pieces of legislation than anything else. And, you know, last spring, as all of you are well aware, George Lynn and I spent about 4.5 months in South Lake Union. And when we left, there were 14 construction cranes. We went back a couple of weeks ago for an annual follow-up, and there were 18 construction cranes. Most of those are for apartments, and there are more apartments being built for residency than the total of Chelan, Douglas, and Okanagan County's population. So it's just an interesting proposition, and pretty much sometimes almost any position we take is just simply, if you're in the shadow of the Space Needle, that's the shadow we're going to live in as well, whether we want to or not. So it's a tough situation.
I think what we've tried to focus on is our core competency. What's the thing that we know a lot about? We know a lot about electricity. We know a lot about electric markets. And so the presentation here today is really focused on the thing that we feel we know the most about. And that our objective is to make sure that the public is aware of the impacts on the PUD and its revenues and costs associated with this proposed legislation. This may evolve to a place over the course of the next week or so where it becomes more intensely impactful to us, and we intend to keep you informed about that, and that may lead to a need for a further conversation. But at this point, we've given you what we know, and we think that that does not lead to a requirement or a demand for the commission to take a position. Yes.
Yep.
I have to chime in here. Oh, go ahead, Randy.
I just said much appreciated, Steve.
I want to chime in and say how much I also appreciate the time, effort, energy being spent on this by everyone. The beginnings of these conversations really started with a desire to understand what any carbon legislation might look like. And to the extent that we had any sway, helped to word it in such a fashion that it at least did no harm to the PUD, and if possible, was even somewhat slightly beneficial to the PUD. And, of course, then the PUD ratepayers and customer owners. There's been a lot of good words said over this topic in the last few weeks. But to the extent that we go beyond having a seat at the table and going beyond being able to help craft verbiage that doesn't harm the PUD, I'm not sure that taking a position one way or the other will have much sway in whether a bill passes or not. What it does do is this is a decisive topic. Commissioner Bolt pointed out there's a great deal of emotion and emotion on both sides. So one of the questions we need to ask ourselves is, what's the benefit of digging our heels in and taking a position beyond being at the table and helping to craft the verbiage? I'm not sure I know the answer to that, but certainly I'm sure over the course of the next week or two, that will become more clear.
I think, of that being said, we should recess.
Could I ask if we could do one thing? We have a relatively short lessons learned.
Okay.
And Bob has been waiting patiently here for an hour, and it's a good one, and I think it's another great example of taking personal accountability. So if we could just hang on for a minute, then I'd love to hear Bev.
Thank you, Tracy. Greg, thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Bob Seebeck. I'm a construction manager in the engineering and project management group. Yeah, so I have a lessons learned from our headquarters re-roof project last year. So it was a nice spring day around a year ago, and one of our employees was out over here on the steps soaking up some warmth, and all of a sudden a tool crashed down beside her. Yeah, very scary. Missed her. There was no injury. So I was notified of this by a second person, and then I thought to myself, all right, that's three people then that know about this. Maybe it's just going to, no, Bob, you can't hide this. You need to get the word out, spread the word, and communicate this. So I got with Ron Franklin, our contractor safety manager, and then the safety group. We then huddled up, and we pretty soon we had a close call that we had produced and communicated with the district. We also had a plan for the contractor moving forward if they were working along the edge of the building, which included then a safe clear zone down below where we had barricades then from going forward. And so anyway, all that really wasn't as painful or didn't hurt like my initial thought was. And by the end of the day, we had, again, a plan with the contractor. We had a different kind of upgraded communication plan, and had communicated this close call. So very successful project. We had the one close call. That was it. And just, you know, sometimes you just, or at least I do, boy, this is going to be a hassle and a headache. It wasn't. It was a great thing to grab it head on and take care of it then. So
it's good.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Good lessons learned.
Yep. Yeah. This one's on agenda item 11, so that's on the consent agenda. That's why Bob is here.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing that forward. You appreciate that.
Yeah. Enjoy your lunch.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Randy took a little credit earlier this morning for two employees having a solid background. I'll take one from Bob. So are we ready for lunch?
Yeah.
With that being said, returning at 1 o'clock, okay with everybody?
Great.
All right, we'll recess and return at 1. Good afternoon. Welcome to Chelan County Public Utility District Board of Directors, our afternoon session. And it is 1:04, and we shall begin. We are at our consent agenda with two considerations to add to it, resolutions 14 and 15. Is there any discussion or any different differential change that we'd like to make? Hearing none, I would take a motion.
Move to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda as modified. Any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor of approving the consent agenda with modifications signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Regular agenda. Mr. Wright.
Well, so this would normally be a study session item, but we were pretty confident we would run long this morning, so we have one item that's a quarterly financial review, the end of year. Kelly Boyd, Craig Kuntz will be presenting.
Good afternoon. That's a little off for me to say. I'm usually saying good morning. So this is a different time than normal on our agenda. But for the record, I'm Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer, and joining me is...
Craig Kuntz, Strategic Financial Planning Manager.
And then we also have other subject matter experts joining us in the audience who we may rely on for some of the details, should there be additional questions. The formality of this presentation, too, is that this presentation supports a number of resolutions that require quarterly reporting to the board for compliance with our... long-range financial policies, our business line financial policies, and our investment policy, as well as the board's balanced scorecard objective of maintaining strong financial stewardship, which also requires this quarterly review. And since this is our year-end review, of note is that the results are preliminary, as always, pending our annual financial audit, which will get underway in a week or so. Since the results are consistent and a little bit better than the Q3 report, we will cover the material rather quickly with highlights of results for the year, a look back, and a look forward, and then we'll leave you with some key takeaway messages. It is update only, and we do, as we like to, include a lot of additional detail in the appendix, but we won't cover that in today's presentation. Key highlights for 2017 is that our bottom line results were better than budget, with the results being $105 million. That's a little bit of an improvement since our Q3 report. And the results are better because of the combination of higher revenues from the colder weather and some contract charges, as well as some lower operating costs. So both of those are in the right direction and both add to the strong results. And those strong results helped us achieve our financial targets for the year and also lead us to recommending that we stay the course on supporting our strategic goals. Reviewing the results in a little bit more detail by major component, let's start with revenues. So net wholesale revenue was a little bit below budget, and the annual result was a little bit lower than what we reported in Q3. And this one is a little bit tricky because one of the things I said about revenues being higher is that we had colder weather, so we used more energy for retail usage. So when we use more for our local load, that leaves less in the surplus market to sell. And so while generation was near normal, there was just less, there was more used for retail, so less available for surplus sales. Prices were a little bit lower than budgeted, but our hedging program really minimizes the impact of the price. So this is more about where the usage ultimately went. And then we also had one mismatch before we budget from where we budget for administrative fees and where we charge them. So we'll get that synced up for next time. For hydro long-term contract revenue, the results were very near the budgeted amounts and pretty close to where we reported for Q3. And the long-term contract revenue, here's another one. Those are cost-based contracts. And I said that costs were lower, so one would think that revenues would be lower. But this has two moving parts here where the costs were lower, but there were also additional contract charges, like some of the charges from Alcoa being curtailed, that offset the costs being lower. So the combination of the two of those resulted in the ultimate revenue being right around budget. So here's where we report our service revenue that was higher because there was more more local load because of the colder weather, and so more revenue in the service revenue area. And our other operating revenue was almost $9 million better than budget, and it was better than our Q3 report. And one of the things that drove this to be better than the Q3 report was we did receive insurance proceeds of about $3 million in Q4 from lost revenue insurance on the Rocky Reach large unit repairs. So this was something that we didn't have in the forecast, because insurance proceeds is one of those things that's really hard to predict when they may come in. And so we didn't have them in the forecast. We kind of wait on something like that until it's actually the check is in the bank before we record the revenues for those types of things. So that was one of the differences between the Q3 report and what was a good addition for Q4. And then this is also the...
Kelly?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, on that insurance proceeds, did that number in essence make us whole, or do we still have a loss because we aren't operating our generators to capacity?
It is a positive boost, but it's not actually doesn't actually make us whole, because there are kind of the equivalent of deductibles and limits. So it's not a one-for-one on the insurance proceeds.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. And then also in that category is some of the miscellaneous charges, like the Alcoa one-year deferral on the contract. That miscellaneous revenue went into this bucket. And then also the variable component of our real-time contract is also recorded here. And that was higher for 2017 also. So this category has a lot of more of the kind of one-time type thoughts that you would think that are in that bucket, contributing to that being better than budget. So that's the revenue side. Moving to the expense side, our operating expenses were almost $1 million below budget, and that's a They came in even a little bit lower than we were reporting on in Q3. Hydro operations and maintenance is the major driver of that, because that they have the most projects going on too, so the most amount budgeted in that area. And many of those projects were just either deferred to next year or delayed due to resource constraints. Then we also had a pension actuarial expense change in our pension accounting. So this didn't impact our pension program at all, but when they do an actuarial calculation each year, your expense can go up and down, even just by the assumptions on earnings or longevity of retirees, that type of thing. So each year we recognize those actuarial changes, and this year it was a reduction in the pension expense. So I'm looking at the table too, and this is one that I'd like to talk about this about equal to talking about depreciation, because these are both non-cash accounting items to record to best reflect the expense and incurring that expense over the life. But on our pensions, we made our full contributions into the pension program, and this is just that, trying to estimate your future cost over the life of pensions.
Kelly, is this similar to a examining what your future pension liability is? Is that what this is when you talk about the actuarial reduction?
Yes. Okay. And so 2 years ago, it was the Governmental Accounting Standards Board also changed how they require you to account for pensions. And so it's not just, did you pay your full obligation into the pension account? They look at the change in the value of the pension as a whole, and then our proportionate share in that. And that's part of what you adjust annually on how that's working.
Thank you.
So this is definitely one of those that each year it's also a little unpredictable of how the expense, the actuarial change may turn out. And then our non-operating expense was a little bit below. This is a net number, and usually it's driven by the net of our debt costs, so interest income less interest expense. Those were right on this year. What was a little bit higher, so making the net expense a little lower, were contributions in aid of construction, so more line extensions than originally planned for. And that's really consistent with the operational updates that you're hearing of growth really kickstarting in the distribution entity and having more line extensions than we've been seeing in recent years. So we look at those costs on a per unit basis, looking at the electric fully loaded cost per average kilowatt hour. It is better than budget, meaning the cost per unit is a little lower. It's a mix between production costs and distribution costs, because when we use more of our production to meet retail load, there are fixed costs in there that more gets allocated to retail than wholesale because we use more. So there was a increase in power production costs over budget because more production was used to serve retail load, but the distribution costs were lower. So the combination of the two did come in lower. And I think this is a good one to connect to a lot of the discussions that we're having. There was a follow-up question from last quarter from Commissioner Smith also. So I'm going to kind of weave this in and then also save it for a little bit later. So this fully loaded cost per average kilowatt hour is a overall average, and it's really taking all the electric costs and putting them into one bucket and then dividing by average kilowatt hours to give us that per unit fill. But it is definitely at that highest level of average. As we talk about some of these key issues that we're facing now, like large loads, high density loads, some of our retail metrics, those are all diving down into lower levels of detail. And so as we get more precise at what categories and what customer types and all of that contribute to the whole, that the more precise detailed components may differ a lot from this. So I think this is a common question to wonder about.
So I'm trying to understand. I think you said this represents the highest level of average, but average is an average. So are you saying it represents the highest level of detail that goes into calculating the average?
So the opposite, the highest summary. This is at the top level of summary information. And then as we get more detailed and more specific on those, that's when we get more, that the numbers relate more closely to the individual components we may be talking about. So this is an overall summary. And so just a really big picture cost per kilowatt hour.
The average thing came to mind, and I thought there isn't a higher level of average, because average is average. I get it. Thank you.
So it's one of those that's hard to explain well, but it's definitely, this is just a summary amount. It's not trying to be cost of service, because in a cost of service, there's offsets, and then we do the cost of service by customer class. And so we allocate costs differently by customer class because they drive the costs differently. So it's not a one-size-fits-all once we get into the details like a cost of service. But this is trying to just be that highest level of what is about the cost to deliver a kilowatt hour.
So we oftentimes say our cost is around 5 cents. Is it really closer to 6?
It's closer to 6 when we were just looking at the big bucket.
Okay.
But if you were to ask that about to deliver retail load versus or residential retail load versus a large retail load, those answers wouldn't be the same.
Okay. So 5 cents is still a reliable.
I'd say 6 cents is what we
a better casual conversation.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. But it can really vary by customer class.
Okay. So again,
average, definitely.
High average.
And then the question that Commissioner Smith asked last time, too, was, and how does this relate to some of our retail electric metrics that we use to help us dive more into the specific detail about retail electric? And so I just want to place that one out there, and I'll answer it when we get to those metrics. I'll try to connect this big bucket to the more specific bucket of costs that we use for those retail metrics.
Kelly, does this number include all of the cost associated with refurbishing the turbines? Is that all thrown into this number?
The O&M costs of refurbishing that and the capital costs spread over the life are all part of the production costs. And then the distribution system buys the energy, that generation, from the hydros, and then we sell some of it. So this is their proportionate cost of that. So it's not 100%, but it's the proportionate share that we have that we use to service our local load and to sell into the surplus market.
And it arrives in that number once it's in the budget? Is that when it hits that, comes into that bucket?
We have both. We do that. We both budget as a whole for the hydros as a whole, and we then recognize what's distribution's proportionate share of that when we look at what's the cost for the distribution system going to be. When we add those both together, we've double counted a few of the things because of the distribution system buying that. But that's where you see inter-system eliminations that come out, so that when we show the end result, it doesn't double count. But so when we look at individual components, though, we have everything budgeted of where the costs go. So to help with that.
So, and Kelly, good, Randy.
This goes back to the question I posed a little bit ago about insurance proceeds, and I doubt that you'll have an answer today. But we're currently doing a lot of rehabilitation on a lot of turbines. How much lost generation do we currently have, and how does that impact that fully loaded charge? But you don't have to answer today.
So I will answer you in two parts. The lost revenue side of it, I will take on as an action item to report back to you on. But the impact on this fully loaded cost, it doesn't impact that because that's a revenue, and this is a cost-focused metric here. So it doesn't impact our cost per unit.
It's a cost per kilowatt hour, though. And if you generate more kilowatt hours, you're spreading your cost over more kilowatts.
So we use average kilowatts in this calculation to take away some of those moving parts like you just described so that we can really zero in on cost rather than quantity of production. So we use average kilowatt hours in the denominator. So it would not be impacted by our actual kilowatt hours generated.
Okay.
I'd like to just point one thing out because this really hit me like a ton of bricks as I'm looking at this and I'm thinking all of our refurbishment cost, which is going to continue to climb, and yet we've held our rates steady for what we charge. So essentially that spread that we're paying to cover, I hate the word subsidized, but the lower rate that we're charging for local residential compared to what our average cost is for production continues to widen because of the refurbishment and the expenses and the capital cost of our projects. And we've kept that rate low for 5 years now, not recapturing any of that additional cost of refurbishment at the hydro projects. So thank you for presenting this that way, because it really landed on me saying, wow, you know, we've got growing costs and we kept our charges static at a subsidized rate.
And that is some of the reasons for the retail electric metrics that we've added that we're doing in a test metric that we will touch base on in a few. That's the reason that we need those at this point in time to help us really zero in on the relationship of cost to rate revenue to wholesale revenue, because not only are costs where we're in a reinvestment mode and we are doing a lot of reinvestments, but also at the same time we have the lower wholesale market prices and maybe lower amounts going in there based on some of the availability factors. And so both of those actually go together to make the difference even more pronounced. And so we want to make sure that we are very deliberate in choices that we're making around that. So we need to dive into the details a little bit more to make sure we understand those contributing factors. So that is a really good reason why we introduced the retail rates to help us learn more about that, the retail metrics. So. And then on hydro production costs on this, we also use the average production amounts per megawatt hour when we do this calculation. And consistent with the hydro costs being less than budget, these metrics are also, you know, better than budget because the cost of per megawatt hour is less in each of the three hydros. So all three are better than budget. In our other services that we provide, water cost per 1,000 gallons is a little bit higher, but this is consistent with the Q3 report where there were some unplanned pump repairs. So this one has been a little bit higher for the second half of the year. Wastewater cost per equivalent residential unit, ERU, is also a little bit higher than budget because of the Dryden pipeline project. Originally started in capital, but once a different route was chosen, it was expensed into O&M, so it raised the cost per equivalent residential unit. And that's also consistent with previous quarter reports. And then the fiber annual cost per active premise is a little bit better than budget, and that's a little bit better than we reported Q3, but still right near there.
Kelly, I'm catching up here. Could you go back one page, please, to hydro production cost per average? Excuse me. So Lake Chelan is 83%, 83% what was budgeted. So I'm just trying to figure out why that is.
Why Lake Chelan is
lower? So much lower. Just curious.
I'm looking to my notes to answer that for Lake Chelan specifically.
Maybe something was deferred. Did we plan some work there and then defer it to?
So it's time to phone a friend. So I think the first person I'll look to is Dave Nelson. Dave, if I could put you on the spot for that.
Miss what's cash cab.
Yeah, Dave Nelson, business advisor. One of the main reasons for that was we have a large project that's O&M there to repair the surge tank at Lake Chelan, and we had some work planned to do some work around that to prepare for that, and a lot of that work didn't get done in 2017 and will be done in 2018.
What's a service tank?
Surge tank.
Oh, surge. Oh, I didn't surge hear tank. You right. Surge. I know where that is. Yes. Okay. Thank you, Dave. Yeah,
thank you, Dave. So transitioning to balance sheet items and starting with capital, our capital expenditures were below the budgeted amount and were a little bit lower than our Q3 forecast. And mostly this is a similar description where work is shifting to 2018, and there is a listing of some of the larger projects that shifted into 2018. But with that shifting, the cash remains strong because we spent less than budgeted on the capital. And so our cash balance increased $28 million in the year, and we ended the year at $511 million of balance in cash. And then our debt also decreased as planned by $52 million, and we ended the year at $537 million of long-term debt outstanding. Translating the narrative to the numbers, here's where you see the dollar results by each of our major components. One of the things that I like to do on this one is show the percentage change from the prior board report. This just gives you a feel, this far right column, of how close we estimated the results to the last quarterly report. You know, most of them are pretty close. Service revenue is better because of the cold weather. Net wholesale revenue is a little bit lower because there was more used to meet our local load, less surplus. Hydro contracts had some of those additional cost plus items that made that a little bit better. And then our other operating revenue is the line here where you see that we were a little bit off from the prior quarter, but that is the insurance proceeds that I mentioned that we didn't have in the forecast that we received in Q4. And then you can see for the rest of the remaining categories, we were very close to the report from Q3. So all of these together resulted in our very strong bottom line of $105 million. When we break that bottom line results into results by business line, you also see that each business line in the integrated electric was a little bit better than budget, as well as our fiber system or fiber business line. And then water and wastewater were a little bit lower results, but mentioned the main drivers of having a couple costs in those areas that were higher than anticipated. When we look at our capital expenditures, this just adds an additional look by the different systems. And you'll see that, across the spectrum, all the systems were a little bit lower than budgeted. When we look at cash, again, one of the common questions asked is, what did you do with all of that cash that you earned this year? So this look really helps with that, where our bottom line results were $105 million. And then we add back non-cash items like depreciation. So our estimated cash earned from operations was $153 million. So what did we do with that? We invested $68 million in capital. We paid down additional $52 million of debt. At the same time, we also received a on the one-year deferral payment from Alcoa. We received amount that we're spreading the revenue across the remainder of the contract, so it's not in the number up above on our bottom line results. So that's a netting there. And then on our payables and receivables, that's timing of when we pay cash out or have cash coming in. And so this is the timing difference on that. So it's really common at year end to, we want to have a clean cutoff, meaning we want to get all of our amounts that we owe recorded. And so our accounts payable, it's normal for that to go up at year end because we are recording all those amounts and we pay them out then in January and February. So all of that together, we added $28 million to our cash reserves.
Is this a new page?
Nope.
Really?
Maybe have the cash detail in here and sometimes we don't. But we've started to include it on the quarterly.
It's formatted differently or something? I like it. It's helpful. I just don't remember it.
Maybe I just delivered it with more enthusiasm this time. and then the next way to look at that, so that was just answering the question of how do we invest that mm-hmm. money and how do we plan to? This looks at the components of our cash and investments mm-hmm. balance. So what makes up that total? And a large amount of that is in our unrestricted funds, which means they're available for any purpose. But a component of our unrestricted funds is our new for 2017, the board designated fund for our strategic facilities plan, where during 2017, we deposited $20 million into the board designated fund at the direction of the board. And while it's board designated, so it's saved for a purpose, it still meets the criteria of unrestricted funds for external reporting. So it's still in that category. Because the board can undesignate it also. So it is in the unrestricted funds balance. But this is also, as we talk about this, maybe a good time just to plant that seed for thinking about this year if the board would like to, consider additional savings for the strategic facilities plan. So that's something that we can plant the seed now.
Can you just give me a lesson here on the year-end 2017 results were $20 million better than budget, but the cash reserves increased by $28,000. So help me understand.
So the reserves
budget versus the $28,000 in reserves.
So the $28 million is $28 increase million. Just from our actual balance from year-end last year to our actual balance year-end this year increased $28 million. And that's where this one helps because how it increased was we had higher than budgeted operating results. And then we spent a little bit less on capital, but we did spend as anticipated on reducing debt, have a few timing items here. So the actual cash balance changed by $28 million, and those budget to actual drivers are all the ones that we describe on the results between revenues and expenses. Does that help answer that? And so finishing off the components, we also have our restricted hydro accounts from our hydro contracts, which is our debt reduction charge and capital recovery charge, which are both balances available to pay capital at the hydros and reduce debt at the hydros. So those actually count in our total liquidity balance that we use for our liquidity metrics. And the reason those count is because we include the capital expenditures as part of what we reserve for and make sure that we have the right liquidity for. So it's a good matching of cash available to pay for what we're planning for. And then beyond that, we do have some restricted funds that are only available to pay for bond reserves, some power contract deposits, and self-insurance that we're required to hold specific reserves. So all of that together is the total of our cash and investments of $511 million. So that kind of helps draw the components to our liquidity targets as well as our total cash balances.
Kelly, excuse me, go ahead, Gary.
No, please go ahead.
I was just going to say on the board designated strategic facilities plan, the initiative for that to be set aside, does that come from staff or does that come from board? And what is the timing on it? And when do we look at that?
So that's a board designated fund. So it's at the desire of the board. And the timeline is also the same at the desire of the board. Okay. So we want to introduce it today.
Yeah.
And then we can take that as an action item, however the board would like us to bring that back, or whatever the preference is of the board. So we just want to introduce it today to plant the seed, and then however you would like to proceed from here.
Okay. We can take a look at that later. Gary?
I'd like to say that the as an undesignated or unrestricted fund, the $20 million that the board has already set aside for a strategic facilities plan at the board's discretion could be reallocated to another purpose if necessary, correct?
Correct.
So moving money into it is a sign of support for a future facilities, but does not restrict it to strictly that purpose, correct?
Correct, but it would take the board to undesignate it,
right,
and change it somewhere else. So I think the real benefit of this is showing that the board is planning ahead and saving for the large strategic facilities expenditures that are in the plan, and it is at the board's discretion, and the board's planning. So I think that was the real benefit of setting some amounts aside in savings, is to show that planning.
So the $20 million that were over budget is just a budgetary excess, correct, over what we had planned for budget. And the $28 million is the actual amount that is been added cash reserves, correct?
Correct. And it is somewhat the number happens to be the same, that we're $20 million ahead of budget this year, bottom line, and we were $20 million ahead. But that's a bit of a coincidence. But it is the same thought process.
Oh, it's becoming an expectation.
That was perfect planning.
That's why I'm saying it was a coincidence. But it is the same train of thought of it was the amount that the 2016 results were better than budget. And if we were to answer that same question of what's the equivalent for you this year, it would also be $20 million better than budget for the bottom line.
Yeah. And I'm sitting here realizing at this time last year, I was not part of this consideration or how it developed or how it was. So I'm going to rely on everyone else, to help guide that process and what it is you want to do and when you want to do it and how do you want to do it. So educate me and we can make a decision. So, yeah. By the way, I'm much happier being here.
We're glad to have you back.
Yes, and we're much happier that you're here also. And we can take that as an action item, I think, to come back at the right timing for you to have that discussion.
Is that appropriate?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I'd like to – I know that there's a coincidence here with it being $20 million this year just as it was last year. But I think I'd like to kind of remove the blinders and take a look at, given our great year that we've had and knowing that we continue to be coached on the fact that revenues look like they're going to be declining going forward. Is $20 million the right number? And so it might be helpful if you could give us some guidance on if we were going to put money in addition to the facilities plan, what would the options be rather than just pick 20 because 20 is there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. So maybe instead of just picking 20, if we know revenue, we know the wholesale market's doing this and revenues are going down and costs are going up, and so maybe it should be $10 million instead of 20. Or, so we give it some real thought, some directed thought, but with your help. Looking ahead for the next couple years.
And I think the thing is really cool is somewhere in the neighborhood of 808 people have all worked together to give us this opportunity.
Absolutely.
And that's a great organization.
And it takes all of us.
Yeah, it does.
Contributing each of our roles to the organization.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just, you know, as a commissioner, you just get to sit here and kind of relish in that, just knowing people have done great work. Yeah, pretty cool.
So Kelly, as a piece of that component, would you be able to, maybe when you present it to us next on your recommendation, kind of circle back with just a broad scope number as to what the head, you know, how much money are we budgeting for a headquarters building?
Yes.
Not the others, just the headquarters building. Thank you.
Kelly.
Yes, Commissioner Smith.
Along sort of the same lines, one of the things that I noticed in this report is there's been a consistent pattern over the last few years of our debt going down and our reserves going up. And I wonder if next year is the nexus of them crossing.
Our investments in hydros and our operating and maintenance programs is definitely sustained at a high level in our forecasts over the next five-year period. So we can also give that comparison of the continued investments and the impact that has on the estimated cash balance also as part of that action item. I think that, would that answer your question?
Well, it was just sort of a curiosity question based on the fact that they are very close today, as close as they've been since I've been a commissioner, those two numbers. And I've been watching the numbers change. And not that it means anything in terms of our financial operation, but it's sort of a, you know, could be a big event that our reserves are bigger than our debt.
Oh, and I'm sorry, I mismatched your question there. I compared it to our investments rather than when we cross over on debt. So I will put that comparison in there also.
Well, I don't mean to cause you extra work. I just think it's something to be proud of.
Yeah, and it's a good number for comparison. So we'll put that in there. And we actually, you know, this year for 2017, we did actually forecast that our cash would decrease with our investments. It's just that we didn't progress as quickly on those cash investments as we forecasted. So we do see declining cash balances, too, as we reinvest that cash in facilities plans, hydros, people.
Right.
And debt reduction.
We do continue to pay down debt, too.
Yes.
For the moment. For the moment.
Well, even for 2018, while we didn't put additional accelerated debt reductions in there, we do have scheduled principal payments. So we will continue to pay down debt principal just through scheduled principal payments.
Right.
And then one thing we like to do at year end that we don't usually do on quarterly is also take a look back so that we can have that good perspective of where our results were for the current year compared to where we've been. Slide 15 is one of those slides that breaks every rule in a good presentation because it has a lot of information packed onto one page. But it's, of course, one that I really love. Because it puts a whole bunch of information that people usually ask when you're looking at results. So this is our bottom line results back to 2007. And you might wonder, oh, is it because it was a really good water year? We have the water information at the bottom. Oh, was it because wholesale market prices were really high? Well, we have the wholesale market prices listed in the middle. We anchor back to when we were in preservation mode because that's before the new contract, long-term contracts, cost-plus contracts were in place. We note the years where those came into play. And then we also noted when we started experiencing some of the Rocky Reach large unit repairs, and we had the unusual Wanapum drawdown that led to additional expenditures. So this is just trying to get all of those items on one page to help with perspective of results and it does show the strong results for 2017.
Great slide.
Thank you. I'm glad I'm not the only one that loves it.
Can you imagine if wholesale market was at 50 megawatts in today's?
Right.
Yes.
And then also translating the comment that Commissioner Arsenault made previously, too, about we have held the residential, the retail rates steady, and this slide shows residential specifically of 5 years without an overall rate increase and as well as not having one budgeted for 2018. But that's why now is the time, as we look at these factors for the future of the continued reinvestments and how that relates to the wholesale market. And now is the right time to work on more detailed plans around this so that we can do anything that may need to be done in small incremental steps over time because we planned ahead.
Yeah, this is kind of an amazing thing. I have a number of relatives in the Southern California area, and realtors carry a map of where the different providers of electrical energy sell. Because you can be on one side of the street and it's 16 cents, you can be on the other side of the street and it's 18 cents. And so it's a factor in selling houses. And I'm looking at this going, well, I don't think our realtors carry that map around.
You know? I don't think so either.
No.
And then we also just dive into, on the next one, some of the this is an expenditure focused piece of the puzzle and tries to compare operation and maintenance expenditures and capital expenditures. So we look at total expenditures, and it just kind of shows the ebb and flow of that as we go through time, and note some of the key cost drivers in those. And it's also a good one, I think, as we talk about our ambitious plans for the next few years and how those are at high amounts compared to where we have been. So this is just another good one for perspective. And then this is also one of my favorites because it shows that at the same time as we are investing in infrastructure and people, we are also maintaining a cash level and reducing debt. So all of those factors together help support our very strong results. And supporting those strong results is that we have met all of our financial metrics on a district-wide basis for the year, and we project that we will also meet them in our five-year plan. And looking at that by business line, we also forecast that we will meet our business line financial policy metrics. And then this is the slide that I hinted on a little bit earlier of these are the test metrics that we've added for the retail electric business line, where they were just new ones added during the year. So we're testing them out to see what we can learn from them. And the intent is to, again, get more familiar with one more level of detail of what's contributing to the retail electric results and to help us plan for the future. And you see that our retail operations, maintenance, and taxes cost ratio, so that's the OM&T, bounces in and out of our targeted ratio, as well as the limit on retail rate support also bounces in and out. So they're pretty close, and it does, you know, go back to positive again in this planning horizon. But really what this is letting us know is that our electric revenues may not be keeping up with our costs as we continue to make the significant investments in our assets, yet our retail revenues aren't growing at the same pace. So the question about this one is also relates to Commissioner Smith's question from last quarter, where this is 90% is our cost ratio target for retail operations, maintenance, and taxes. But if we think back to that cost per kilowatt hour, that was about 6 cents. and we know our rates are about a little over 3 cents, one might think that this metric should be 50%, or the question that Commissioner Smith asked is even, how does that 50% mental math there compare to this 90% target? And this is one where this is diving more into the details specific to retail electric. The overall summary of 6 cents includes retail, wholesale, transmission, all of that in a big bucket. We allocate those costs specific to the cost drivers. And when we look at retail electric specifically, and we're just looking at operations, maintenance, and taxes, not some of the other items like depreciation and that type of thing. This is just a more narrowly focused metric on these items specifically, and that's why it's a different percentage than just looking at that overall 6 cents versus 3 cents. So I hope that that helps answer that question for you, Commissioner Smith.
Yes, thank you.
Quarterly investment report, which is also one of our required reportings, our yield for 2017 and for Q4 remains relatively near the same. And we, again, expect we are in compliance with all of our investment objectives and think our path we're using with our investment strategies will continue to be our path as rates are on a slow improvement, but support our strategies. So bringing that all together, our key messages to leave you with is that our results were better than budget for the year. Our long-term financial policies are on track, although as we've been talking about, we do see that revenues from wholesale electric sales do look to be declining in the future as our investments are increasing. And so when we put those together, we do, so our cash reserves are expected to decline also. So we do see that in our planning horizon, our needed investments combined with our less revenue does mean that borrowing our new debt and managing our revenue will be needed sooner than previously forecast. So it is in our forecast horizon now, and that's factoring into some of the topics that you see us bringing to the board throughout 2018. So even with all that, we still recommend that we stay the course with our strategic goals and continue to reinvest in core assets and people. Continue to achieve that debt ratio less than 35%, which we have targeted to achieve 1 year early in 2018, even with just paying scheduled debt this year. That will be a biggie. We also recommend continuing the public power benefit program, and then consistent with the action item that you requested of us, also consider designating additional funds to savings for the strategic facilities plan. Any additional questions?
Kelly, do you have any in your item here where managing revenue will be needed sooner than previously forecast issuance of debt? What target, 2020?
On the managing revenue or on the debt?
On the debt, sorry.
It's 2022-ish is the range there. Could be a little faster if we make more investments. Our track record has been a little slower.
Sure.
So it's around, our forecast is for 2022, so it would be in that zone. Although we do run out of hydro funds sooner than that, but we have the internal ability to do some internal loaning. So 2022 is going to the external debt market. But that is one of the things that we monitor all the time. So it's possible that maybe the market would warn us going sooner just because of market factors or maybe reissuing some of our existing debt, doing a refunding for savings. So sure. While that's when we're forecasting, we actively manage that. And we could see some scenarios where we would be in the market sooner because it would be favorable.
Any other thoughts, questions, comments? Really nice. It's really nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Next up, we're going to have Dave Nelson come up and give the quarterly capital projects report.
And Commissioners, Dave Nelson, Business Advisor, and I've got reports that we present quarterly to supporting the delegated authority. The first one is the active major capital projects report. It's a capital project with $2 million budget or greater. And I would note we don't have any cost variances to go over on this page. I would note I'm just going to hit highlighted items that have change during the quarter. So there's a lot of other numbers on here. Feel free to ask questions about them. On the first page, there aren't any budget variances, but we do have a number of schedule variances, and those are the red circles with the X's in them. The first three are related to our Powerhouse 1 modernization programs. B6, as you're aware, has been delayed in the completion of that unit's modernization, and that directly impacts the schedule for B7. We will be starting B7 after B6 is complete. So that delayed that one additionally from a prior report, as well as delaying B2 when we look at rescheduling all of the units down at Powerhouse 1 to make that schedule work. The next one down, ENIAC Park upgrades, that's a delay that was already reported to the commission. That project is complete. The Headworks gantry crane is a small additional delay that had already been reported to the commission. That crane is in service. The old crane has been removed. It's just a project closeout issue that we're just finalizing. And then the Rocky Reach bridge cranes, I believe you're well aware of the delays and the additional work we've seen that's required on the Rocky Reach bridge cranes, and so those we expect to have that crane back in service in the April timeframe and close out the project in June. So additional delay there. As part of that, the next three that you note are also crane projects that we've delayed and just kind of rescheduled when we felt was the priority and the right time to do these. We're using the same consultant and experts on and internal experts on those crane projects. And we identified the need to delay the Powerhouse 1 intake gantry crane, and also the two cranes at Powerhouse 2. Those are still on track to be completed well ahead of our Powerhouse 2 modernization program, so we don't anticipate any problems there. The domestic water tower and piping at Rock Island Powerhouse 1 was rebid, and so that has delayed that project a little bit. The security infrastructure and the fleet distribution are delays that were previously reported last quarter to the board. So that's it on the first page. With the next two pages are capital project budget revisions that were done during the quarter. The first section in green is utility services for a net small change of about $29,000. The main drivers there were line extensions in the distribution area. Those are customer requests for line extensions, and there was more than what were expected in our budget, and also some additional pole replacements that were done as we were able to get more work done than what was planned. The next section is a small adjustment for it in the transmission projects. In the purple section, the first part is the public power benefit projects for fiber, and those are just reallocating between the projects as they're funded. And the lower section is primarily driven by an increase in budget needed for fiber devices, which is caused by additional customers connecting up service, about 100 more customers than what were budgeted. So that drove a need for additional budget for fiber devices. The last one on the first page is a governor air compressor replacement, and that's just a change in scope in that project to make it work a little bit better for us there. On the next page, we have hatcheries adjustments, and really the driver here is Rock Island flow meters related to water rights and our need to have meters on a number of locations. That's actually dollars that will be spent in 2018 and 2019, but we did establish the project at the end of 2017, and so we have it on this report. Only $14,000 was spent in 2017. Fleet, it's actually a reduction in the budget overall, reallocation to the vehicles that were purchased. And then the next section for facilities, we have a large item for the Rock Island facilities upgrade. And again, this is really a future expenditure, but because we did spend about $92,000 in 2017, we need to establish the project that was approved through the board's budget filing in December. The remainder is planned for 2018 through 2020. And then there's a small IT adjustment of $10,000 to the server network infrastructure.
Dave, before we move,
yeah.
help me understand what an electrofisher is.
Which one is that?
Fourth one down at the top of the page.
You know, I will have to get back to you unless there is a
just throw something electrified.
Fish and wildlife expert.
People, you know, if you throw dynamite in a lake, they get stuff.
I knew that's where you were headed with that.
So no, I was just.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know. So yeah. I have to ask Aline about that one.
Yeah, I see her. You know, at the end of this, so. Yeah, that'd be interesting just to know.
Okay, and then the next three pages are active contracts greater than $1 million. And the first four items are related to our B5 through 8 contracts to modernize those units at Rock Island Powerhouse 1. Those will all have to be extended. We already have the contract provisions in place to be able to do that. It's just really us working with Andritz and administratively to determine when we will finish these, and we'll be extending these purchase contract agreement dates as needed. The first item in green is a new item on here. That's for unit C10 for the turbine repairs. That was an existing contract, but we've just established now that particular work agreement to allow work to begin on C10 for some components. On the next page, there's one item is the new security contract with Allied Universal. That's a three-year agreement that was entered into. And then on the next page, there's a few items. The first is a new two-year agreement with Okanagan Nation Aquatic Enterprises for a Skaha hatchery rearing cycle. And Skaha is the hatchery in Canada that we contract for the sockeye mitigation services from the Okanagan Nation. And then those sockeye, after they've been reared in the hatchery, are released into the Shingle River and come down the Okanagan to join the Columbia at Lake Bateros, just above Wells Dam.
Thank you.
And that was a little bonus information from a question this morning. No charge, no extra charge for that. But I didn't know the answer before, and so I had to research that and get the answer. The next one down is TFC architecture. This is an additional task authorization under the agreement for the Rock Island Dam facilities. And then the last item here is with McFarland Cascade Pole and Lumber. This is a transmission and distribution poles. And the reason this one appears on the report is actually because we increased the amount. We added to this purchase contract, and it then bumped over $1 million. And so then it appears on this report. It's actually been in place since May of 2016. And then I would note there are no negotiated contracts. There were no negotiated contracts during the 2017 fourth quarter. And that's it.
Any questions, comments?
Would you like to know what a electrofisher is?
I would. I've been dying.
According to Lean, it is a weed whacker looking thing that you stick in the water, applies a mild charge to the water so you can see what kind of fish are present for sampling, counting, tagging, etc. So it must be like a radar-ish thing.
It's not a stun gun.
Not according to this, although it has some of the same principles applied, apparently.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
We should have one of those.
Dave, thank you for your report.
Okay.
Yeah.
And good Thanks. Report.
It's kind of like what Steve uses during the senior team meetings.
Well, I'm thinking that would be an electoral prop. It's vision for nothing. So we are at manager items.
I want to invite David Lodge and Jeff Smith to come up and talk about a public meeting that we're scheduling for Wednesday.
And commissioners, directing your attention to this. This has been passed around. Jeff Smith, Managing Director of District Services.
And David Lodge, Project Manager.
There's been a long-time issue of runoff that flows through an open ditch across the PUD's Leavenworth property. The water comes from higher terrain, impacting private and public property and creating a wetland before the flow goes into Chumsett Creek. David is coordinating a meeting of stakeholders this week involving Chelan County, the City of Leavenworth, and private property owners. And the purpose of the meeting is?
Our plan for the meeting is to listen to the neighbors' concerns about the wetlands and what they would like to see done to resolve the drainage and flooding issues on a long-term basis. And even though the wetland is on PUD property, there are more parties involved because it's drainage from the county and the city. And so we're partnering with those agencies to try to come up with a collaborative solution. And there isn't a simple answer to it. If there was, we would have done something already. So we're trying to work collaboratively with city, the county, and the neighbors to find something that's going to resolve these issues for a long-term solution.
So some of the concepts have been developed.
So we've looked at doing an overflow pipe that would maintain the water level in the wetland and keep it from flooding. But there are some major restrictions for doing work in the wetland, and it would be a pretty costly alternative to do that. We've also looked at doing a piped conveyance through there, but it would require off-site mitigation for destroying the natural wetland area. And we've looked at possibly moving the wetland away from the neighbor's property. And again, none of the solutions is the obvious answer. And that's where we really want to collaborate with the neighbors to understand what their concerns are, not just the ones who have been vocal and reached out to the district, but for all of the surrounding neighbors and what they would like to see done long term.
So Commissioners Congdon and Smith were invited by one of the property owners last year and visited on site, walked the property, and took a look at it. As David indicated, there is no easy solution. But the bottom line from our standpoint, our message is we're in this together. We all have some responsibility, and we need to develop a mutually acceptable agreement. Happy to answer any questions.
Natural wetlands or contrived?
Depends who you ask. It is recorded as a wetland, so we need to respect that.
Okay. So it's immaterial whether it came about by development or other kinds of things over time, or if it just happened to be there and the development came up around it, it still doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's designated, so there we are.
Yeah. It's waters of the state, and there is natural drainage that flows through there. There's natural water. In addition, there's stormwater, which makes the problem worse for spring runoff.
Are there any fish in there?
I have not seen any fish in there. I doubt there would be.
Commissioner Bowles, there's a lot of asphalt feeds the water into this. So over a period of many years, water doesn't have a place to go.
Okay. So over time, it's been inadvertently mitigated. Or has become problematic?
Hasn't been mitigated yet. We're still dealing with it. We do keep the open channel open, so there's a free flow and it doesn't pool up. They're having some issues of impacting private property.
Yes, where we can do maintenance, we have performed maintenance in the past. But, again, we're restricted in the actual wetland area. Yeah. But something needs to be done for a long-term solution.
Okay.
Commissioners, I was just going to say this is actually an issue we've been facing for 15 to 18 years. I've been involved several times, worked recently with David and Jeff on this. The struggle has been and continues to be the PUD is responsible for the portion of the drainage that crosses its property. And we've taken care of that. As David mentioned, we've been doing some work in keeping that clean and free and open. The problem really is, as development occurs, more water comes down, and others aren't engaged in quite the same level of maintenance as the PUD is. And we're trying to find a solution where everybody contributes as opposed to the PUD taking it on. There's a strong need and desire, at least on this attorney's part, to not solve the problem for everyone. There's when you have those natural drainages, if you touch it as a municipality, you tend to own it going forward, as the City of Seattle and the Port of Seattle have learned several times over there. So.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
I'm going to ask John Stoll to come up. We're getting close to our every 2 years customer survey.
Steve, I need to ask one other question. At this meeting on Wednesday, yeah, but no more than one commissioner, or I mean, how many are looking at going? Or so we.
I am not.
Okay, I'm not, but you are.
I think I will.
Okay, so we.
I may go. I'm not sure. Right. I'm going to try.
But I think Randy, you're going to stay where you are, so I don't think we
right.
We won't have a quorum. So okay, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Who's going to be there running the meeting tomorrow? David will be?
Yes.
I should have. I wanted to see if I could get somebody 10 or 15 minutes before the meeting to meet me and show me where, so I could look at it before I went to the meeting.
Other items?
Huh?
Well, look who's there.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. As Steve has mentioned, we are right on the cusp of doing our every other year customer satisfaction survey. So this year, Bill Robinson and Robinson Research is poised to start, and with your concurrence, they would start that tomorrow. This year, the survey focuses on the critical issues or questions we seem to always ask for consistency, overall customer satisfaction, reliability, communication on some issues, some verbatim comments and whatnot. A little bit shorter this year. There are a few specialized questions, but anticipate customers should be able to get through it in 10, 15 minutes. I heard from Bill, they did a test sample this weekend. It went fine, so the survey flowed well, so they're ready to commence again tomorrow with the field work. If everything goes as planned, most likely, probably the second meeting in March, Bill would probably come back and present the results.
There was an email that was sent out with the survey questions mm-hmm. that I took a look at, and looks like a good survey.
Yeah, it should be good. I think we pared it down a little bit from the last one.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Eric, LUD foreclosures?
Yes, Commissioners, thank you. Eric Walk with General Counsel. So it's that time of year, Commissioners, where we have to take a look at our outstanding book of accounts from the local utility district assessments, and the statutes require us to take action to foreclose on assessment accounts that are delinquent for more than 2 years unless they're in bankruptcy or have some other mitigative circumstance in place. So this year we have two potential accounts that are currently delinquent and require action. One of them we're hopeful can be resolved prior to taking that action, but I do need a motion from the board authorizing me to file those actions by, frankly, March 1, before March 1, if it becomes necessary to do so. Want to take a minute and recognize Megan McCarty in Utilities Customer Service Group. She manages these accounts, and then she works in conjunction with Debbie Litchfield and Finance help prepare the legal packet so they're ready to go, and they mitigate the cost and expense of having to file those actions as much as possible. And then most importantly for me, I think for the district, they really are bulldogging these things and getting them resolved if at absolutely all possible prior to having to take legal action. But the statute does require us to do so, and so I'd ask you for a motion if you have no questions.
Mr. Commissioner, I would like to I request a motion authorizing General Counsel to file foreclosure actions on or before February 28, 2018, as appropriate to enforce and collect delinquent LUD assessments.
Second that.
It's been moved and seconded, authorizing general counsel to file foreclosure actions on or before February 28, 2018 is appropriate to enforce and collect delinquent AUD assessments. Discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Yeah. And John Stoll, while the name of Megan McCarthy came up, I did receive a text about a week ago from a customer who received what they felt was exceptional service for Megan McCarthy. And if you could pass that along, I'd really appreciate it.
Okay, last item. I want to ask you to check your calendars. So we had a large public power council meeting a couple of weeks ago, and there was a speaker there from eSource who focuses really on how to create great customer satisfaction using new technology and tools, and also just thinking through what their needs are. He's going to be in the Northwest and offered to come here. Kevin Nort and I were both there, and so we looked at our calendars and said, he said he could be available on April 13th. We thought about the possibility of a joint board meeting with Grant and us. So checking to see if you would be available. It's a Friday. probably could make it work anytime that day.
The date again, April?
April 13th.
13th.
Works here.
Thomas Jefferson's birthday.
Yes. yeah, as long as it concludes before 4 o'clock.
Shouldn't be hard.
Okay.
Yeah, works for me.
Steve McKinney, yes?
Yes.
Randy, you said yes?
Aunt? Correct.
Can you believe that?
So we'll firm up the date and bring back a special
Thank you.
Meeting
if we need to.
Yeah. We'll probably shoot for the morning. Yeah, it's okay. I think he suggested he could be here in the morning.
I don't know that we've ever hit a 5-0 agreement on a date that quickly. It's been a really good day. Thank you.
That's it.
Commissioner items.
None here.
Okay. Thank you. Steve? Gary?
No.
Randy?
Nope.
What's the date?
Just one brief one. I have submitted to Rebecca, who has submitted the information to, I think, Lena on our assignments at Waputa. And basically, they're all in the same slot. And we have the same person listed as the alternative, which is usually a staff member. And then the only change is that if one and two are not present, I would then fill in any of the commission items. So that puts us three deep in most situations. So, and that's gone into Lena, so we will, she'll set it up in terms of our identifier cards at the tables. And that's it. Commissioner Travel.
Hello, Commissioners. Lisa Sanders, Admin and Finance. Looking over your upcoming travel, I have Commissioners Bowles and Arsenault traveling to D.C. next week. And I've emailed you both your hotel information, so you have it.
Yeah, and I saw that, and thank you very much.
I had a question on yours if
sure.
You could just respond to me
okay.
Before
all right.
Too long. Commissioner Congdon traveling to Anchorage March 7th. And we have March Waputa with hotel rooms held. Commissioner Congdon not attending. Commissioner Bowles at Town Place. Everyone else at the DoubleTree. And I expect to have the registration forms in a couple days. Then Commissioner Congdon, are you doing the Water Committee on the 29th? Okay. Do you need airfare?
Let's talk later.
Okay. In April for Waputa, we have rooms held, Commissioner Congdon. We have airfare and a car rental as well. Commissioner Arsenault, for May 9 and 10, needed to know what nights you need for a hotel.
I'll get back to you on those.
Okay.
And Lisa, could you add me to that agenda? The telecom workout.
Telecom, yes.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And in May, we have the NWPPA annual conference in Boise. Does everyone plan to attend that?
Yes.
I do, for sure.
I need to check. I need to check my schedule. I'll have to let you know on that.
Commissioner Smith, that was yes?
Correct.
Thank you. Okay. That looks like that's as far out as I have rooms held.
Lisa, you can cross me off the APP annual conference.
I'm happy to stand in for you on that one, Commissioner, if you'd like. Give them the location.
Go for it.
Eric, you're so nice.
I know. That was a big gift.
Lisa, speaking of that, do you have rooms for the APPA annual conference yet or not?
Not yet.
Okay. Didn't know if they'd been released yet or not. But
I haven't seen anything, but I'll double check.
I just received something over the weekend, and the hotel has been selected. It's a Hilton. I can get that to you.
Okay. And is anyone planning the June 28th Water Committee? I think Commissioner Congdon is. Was anyone else?
No.
That's why we love her so much.
And you have a June 17th Waputa for July?
I'm sorry?
I think that was
Did you say June 17th?
It's a Water Committee, isn't it?
And then, oh, okay, June, yeah. I'm ahead of you. I'm
sorry.
July.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah.
So probably just Commissioner Congdon for June 28th?
Yes.
Okay. And then July 18 to 20 for the Waputa meetings in Chehalis. Commissioner Gordon, right. You're not attending? Okay.
I will probably attend that.
You
can put me down on that one.
For going?
Yes. Okay.
And Lisa, one you do not have, I don't think, is July 21 through 24 is APPA policymakers.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I will include that. Do you plan on attending?
Yes.
Okay. Anyone else?
And which one was that?
The
policy.
Oh, no.
APPA policymakers?
No. So on the APPA annual...
conference?
Yes. I'll be traveling on the 17th. So the first 2 days of it are optional.
Okay.
So I'll be traveling on the 7th. So traveling and arriving on the 17th.
Okay.
And my anticipation is I will be traveling on the 14th because of the day of giving on the 15th.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And same as me, I'm going to go to the day of giving as well.
Okay.
So that's, we're talking about June. Mm-hmm.
Yep. You as well. So that's arriving on the 14th. Okay.
Yeah, I have a granddaughter skating that weekend.
Oh, fun.
So it's like, got to go.
Okay. So I can get to work on those. Is there anything else? For now?
And the answer to your email is we have a place to stay.
Oh,
we've made arrangements. Thank you very much.
So we're all right. Okay.
Yeah, for considering that. I appreciate it.
I didn't want you to be sleeping on the sidewalk.
No, no. I've seen that happen in D.C. I don't want to be there.
Lisa, I'll be attending the water workshop in September. That's a yes for sure.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Commissioners, we're going to bump into another one of these conflicts between a convention and a board meeting. So June 18th, is we have a scheduled board meeting at the same time as the APPA National mm-hmm. Conference. So we will need to come back with you as we did. And
just change the location.
No problem, right here.
We'll need to come back to you with some options for how to manage that.
I don't think a staff would mind being
not this staff, although June is a hot month in New Orleans.
I'll have to switch my update to the second meeting, though, instead of the first.
Any questions of Lisa? Thank you very much for being patient with us.
Oh.
We are.
Sorry I didn't make it to the last meeting.
We're a loose herd. It takes a skillful shepherd.
Well, thank you.
19, follow-up on delegation of action items from previous.
So first of all, we had one all the way back to December 18th, which we knocked off the list today, which was getting back on the Chelan Rotary Planet Walk. So that one's done now. We have two from the last time that we're just putting into that. We're going to bring them back to you. One is on the contractor safety program. Promise to get you some more information about that. Jeff Smith's working on that. And then Eric's going to just do a quick update on the Voting Rights Act discussion.
Right. So, Commissioners, I haven't had any feedback from any of you since I did my summary to you. I don't know if that's a good thing because it was clear or I've confused you. at this point, I'm going to think I'll leave it in your pocket. And if you need something from me, please reach out. And, Commissioner Bowles, if there's something you would like me to be doing as president, you let me know.
Okay. So I'll take direction from the other commissioners. And
thank you.
I'd be happy to do that.
I'm at your service, but I don't think it's your issue. And
okay. So that's all the follow-up. So delegation of action items.
Okay. Rebecca has captured quite a few here.
There's one on the back.
Okay. We might have an all-time record here today. So first of all, how do we match up our sales we make to our current portfolio, getting back to this, what's our load and how if the load changes, are we stressing the system to be able to make sure that we can meet our retail loads with our existing generation? Come up with some advantages and disadvantages of a moratorium approach. Making sure that as we look at this really goes back to the first one, as we look at the system power usage, we're looking at both the expected case and the stressed case. And what options we have when our system is at capacity and when we're at that stressed case. Take a look at the fiber system capacity related to large loads and whether that's creating an exposure there. There'll be some conversation with Eric regarding obligation to serve. Kelly is going to get back to you with respect to how much lost generation do we have with the hydro projects and not how does that impact the average cost, because I think she explained that that we're using the same average every year. The denominator doesn't change, but just just some sense of what our lost opportunities are and what the current outages that we're experiencing. We're going to bring you some options for the increase to the reserve fund for facilities, the board designated reserve fund. I'm not sure about that one either. So the note that Rebecca made, so you guys will have to help me because I'm not sure if I remember this one either.
Randy's question, but I'm not sure I understood it.
This was Commissioner Smith's question, comparison of cash decrease to anticipated new debt. Oh, I see. This is the crossover point.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Okay. So Kelly says she's got it. She knows what that
getting
is.
Getting closer, and it looks like it, we may be there next year.
Yeah.
According to the graph. Yeah.
Okay. So that's what we got.
Just clarification on the one topic, and that was the reserve, putting money in reserve for facilities,
mm-hmm.
is that the question was, is $20 million the right amount? And it could be less than $20 million, but it couldn't be more than $20
million. Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Well, I suppose it could be.
Mm-hmm. And asking Kelly to take a look at it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So, Randy, did you have a comment, or are you okay?
I'm fine.
All right.
Kelly captured what I was after.
Okay. Additional public comment? Matters of general business, as may necessarily come before the commission. Executive session. Following our regular meeting, we would go into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or likely to become a party, and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 42-30111I, and to consider the selection of a site or the acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase when publicly acknowledged regarding such consideration would cause a likelihood of increased price as authorized by RCW 42.30.111. B. Time?
30 minutes.
30 minutes. So do we want to take a short break, 5-minute break? So starting at 2:45 and lasting till approximately 3:15, we will go into executive session. This is Chelan County PUD Board of Directors coming out of executive session. And returning to our regular session, during executive session, no votes were taken, no decisions were made. Is there anything else to come before the commission? Hearing none, we're adjourned.